For businesses around the world, today isn't a restart, it's a rethink. That's why they're partnering with IBM. Retailers are keeping their systems up as millions of orders move online. Call centers are using IBM Watson to manage customer questions with AI. And solutions built on the IBM cloud are helping patients receive trusted information. Today we're rethinking how business moves forwards. Let's put smart to work. Visit ibm.com/smart/UK to learn more.
Night one of the WWE draft is in the books, and already I see a lot of people complaining. Oh, they broke up the New Day. How could they do that? That's a terrible move. No, it's not. I'm here to tell you why it's a good move. In fact, I'd say it's a great move. Splitting Big E away from the rest of the New Day. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about Retribution. Mustafa Ali, the new leader of Retribution. Could this be what saves this storyline, or could it drag Ali right down with it? Alberto Del Rio is about to find out that orange is not necessarily a good look for him. I've got a bone to pick with AEW over its ranking system. Poor Ridge Holland, in the midst of the biggest push of his life, suffered a gruesome injury on NXT this week. We have an update, and it's not good. And over 20 years ago this week, the worst pay-per-view of all time took place. I'll explain why and some other details that you may not have been aware of. All that and more on episode 673 of the Solomonster Sounds Off.
It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solomonster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster
conquered the street.
We like fighting a woman.
What is with this company's obsession with ninjas?
Oh my God, we're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
Come over here and fight me.
Too many ninjas.
You haven't been beat up properly.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Welcome to episode 673. The Solomonster Sounds Off here for Sunday, October 11, 2020. I am the Solomonster. I want to thank everybody up front here for all the birthday wishes, all the nice emails. That Dynamite stream on Wednesday night was like nothing I have ever seen before with all of the super chats. We had Professor John Gotti super chatting himself right into the record book. So again, I can't thank you guys enough. It was a fun week. And I just found out yesterday that Pro Wrestling Tees has extended their fall sale through today. So time is running out if you want to take advantage of the sale for the new 13-year anniversary Sound Off t-shirt in our store. You can get 20% off if you're listening to this on Sunday when you use the code FALL at checkout. Go to prowrestlingtees.com/solomonstersoundsoff and you will see the brand new 13-year anniversary t-shirt. Probably, if it isn't my favorite, it's probably one of my top two favorite designs in the store. A lot of people have picked it up so far. And so if you want to get 20% off, that is the place to go ahead and do that today. And you guys know the drill with Audible. You can still get yourself a free book when you use the link audibletrial.com/solomonster. Show some love for our longtime sponsor, Audible. And get yourself one free book in the process. All the PayPal folks, if you want to send in PayPal, you can do so, completely up to you. But the link is always there on thesolomonster.com. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout out here as part of our weekly roll call, because we got a lot to get to here. We got the draft to talk about. We got to talk about Alberto Del Rio. We got to talk about Retribution. We have a whole bunch of injuries to talk about, including one very gruesome injury from NXT this past week. Not to mention all the history stuff, so we got a lot to get into here. But first, we got roll call, and that includes DeVenom, John Iru. Thank you, John. Thank you for the bomb and the birthday message. Steven Handyman Halistick, thank you for the bomb. The Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, Deadpool James Herrera, Killshot Keith Hart, Damn Straight Michael Dorsey, Rockhard Russell Segee, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichert, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, got Max the Axe Velotto. Thank you, Max. HBO Max, dropping some love this week. The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep. Josh the Shooter Stockton. Night Stalker, Naif Al-Safar. Ostentatious Alan Carter. The Firebomber, Craig Foster. The Redneck Rookie, Edward Valenzuela, the Carolina Panther, Bradley Gooch, powerful Pierre Degagne, Raymond the Mountie Medina, Stormy Skies, Ryan Spies, James Hollywood Henderson, a man's man, Matthew Webb, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto. We got Sweet Sapphire, Sarah Kittleson. Thank you for the card and the email. Very nice of you. We have the last handsome man, Louis Rosen. A very happy birthday to Louis from his good friend, Noel. Primetime, Patrick Struble. I'm thinking about Patrick and his family, as he knows. So, Patrick, if you hear this, I hope you're doing okay. And Gabriel Soul, if you hear this, I've tried to respond to your email twice, and both times I've gotten messages back that your inbox is full, so either email me again from a different address or clean out your damn inbox. So I just wanted to relay that message. I have no other way to get in touch with Gabe. I can send smoke signals, I can do Morse code. Hopefully he hears this. And you can also leave 5 stars and a review, if you would be so kind, on iTunes for the show, if you like what you hear. Fodal88 says, I'm so happy my friend showed me this podcast a couple of years ago. It is honestly the best wrestling pod out there. At first, I was hesitant because the name was so weird, but now I can't get enough. And A. Betancourt 1505 says, great podcast, easy to listen to, and very knowledgeable on wrestling. Unfortunately, with my work schedule, I cannot watch WWE or AEW hardly ever, but this podcast keeps me up to date. Well, I aim to serve. There are a lot of people who actually choose not to watch wrestling anymore, but they can't quite give it up. You know, it's like once it gets in your blood, it's hard to get it out. So even the ones who aren't really enamored with the WWE or even the AEW product, they will still listen to the podcast so they can at least keep up with everything that's going on. I think they also enjoy listening to the historical talk, which I do as well, which is why I wanted to make that part of the show again. But whatever your desires are and your likes, I think we offer a little bit of everything here on the show. So let's get into this here. Before we even get into all the news of the week with the draft and all the on-screen stuff, I did want to address this because this was an update that PW Insider provided. I had been wondering if there was any kind of update on this, and it has been almost a year since Matt Travis was killed by a dump truck driver here in New York. He was only 25 years old. Matt was a well-known name in the Northeast wrestling scene, the independent wrestling scene. He was a staple in House of Glory. I had the pleasure of helping to call some of his matches. He was riding his bike home from wrestling training on November 9th last year when a dump truck driver made an illegal left turn and struck him and just kept on driving. And instead of charging the driver with hit and run, they only charged him with relatively minor crimes that carry maybe a month in jail at the most. And I remember reading one, it was either an article or a blog post at the time that said prosecutors in these situations, they often have a difficult time proving to a jury that the driver knew that they hit someone when they claim, oh, I didn't know. Now, I don't know if that's what this guy is claiming. I have no idea if this guy is claiming he didn't know that he hit Matt. He probably is, but I don't know if that's the case here or not. But, you know, to me, he still broke the law. He was the one who made an illegal turn. And not only that, he was the second driver from the same trucking company in the span of 2 months last year who killed someone. And yet PW Insider reports that court documents show the driver pled guilty last month to reckless driving and failure to exercise due care, causing serious injury, and failure to yield to a bicyclist. And as a result, his license has been revoked for 6 months. He paid a $250 fine, and he'll get an unconditional discharge in 1 year if he stays out of legal trouble, meaning the case would be sealed. And right now, he remains free. His next court date has been scheduled for December 4th. That hardly sounds like justice to me. Matt and his family deserve better. Alberto Del Rio looks to be going away for a long time after being indicted by a grand jury this week on 1 count of aggravated kidnapping and 4 counts of sexual assault. This according to the Bexar County DA's office in Texas. You may recall this stems from the incident on May 3rd of this year. I talked about this during my Money in the Bank review. It was breaking news during my Money in the Bank review. I talked about it there. I talked about it again on Sound Off 652. In case you have forgotten what this scumbag is accused of doing, let me remind you, and I will warn you that the details here are pretty disturbing. For those of you who are looking for some leisurely listening here on a not so beautiful Sunday, it's kind of a gloomy Sunday here in New York. I don't know how it is where you are, but this gets a little disturbing. So Del Rio, you know, his real name is Jose Rodriguez. He was allegedly in a relationship with this victim at the time, and he accused her of being unfaithful. And he wanted her to admit that she was unfaithful, and she cheated on him, and she refused. The woman claims that he was abusive with her on more than just this one occasion. It should be pointed out, this is not an isolated incident, according to her. But this time, he allegedly slapped her around at least 10 times, made her put on a dress, and wanted her to dance for him, which I think she refused to do. That prompted him to warn her not to cry, or he would take her son and drop him off in the middle of the road somewhere. And he then allegedly tied the woman's hands behind, I don't know if it was behind her back or not, but he tied her hands with boxing straps. He put a sock in her mouth. She claimed that she couldn't breathe. And he assaulted her with various objects, including his penis, for over 16 hours. She says the attack lasted from around 10 p.m. on May 3rd to 2:30 in the afternoon the following day, causing visible injuries. That's according to the responding officers on the scene. They took pictures. They have it all documented. She had bruises on her face, on her arms, on her legs, on her neck. Should be noted that Del Rio is a 6'4" man. He's 6'4", 240 pounds. The victim here, this woman, is 5'5", 130 pounds. Yeah, real tough guy. Real tough guy. Now, if convicted on the aggravated kidnapping charge in the state of Texas, he faces a minimum of 5 years in prison or a max of life in prison. For each of the sexual assault charges, and there's four of them, he faces a minimum of 2 years or a maximum of 20 years if convicted. Now, I don't think he's getting life in prison. Probably should, but I don't think he's getting life in prison. But it looks like he's only going to have, I'd say, oh, I don't know, maybe about an hour a day out in the yard. About an hour a day of daylight out in the sun for quite a few years, if this thing goes the way that I think it's going to go. And you know what? It couldn't happen to a nicer guy. At least we won't have to read these reports that used to pop up every few months anymore about Vince McMahon has an interest in bringing back Alberto Del Rio. Yeah, you know where those reports came from? Alberto Del Rio. That's where those reports came from. This alleged interest that WWE had these last few times in bringing him back. It never made any sense with the baggage this guy brings with him. Why they would even think that he would add any value. Why they think that he was such a big name and a big, like he moved the needle so much, oh, we got to bring back Del Rio. It never made any sense. It's because he would constantly say, oh, I'm in talks with WWE. I'm in conversations with WWE. Yeah, you're full of shit. So we won't have to hear these stories anymore, thank God. Hey, look, in the Pokey, if they give him some internet time, maybe he could be part of the Thunderdome audience. That's about as close as he's ever going to get to being back on WWE television. The WWE draft kicked off on Friday night on SmackDown. It wraps up tomorrow night on Raw. No NXT involvement. Even Triple H up until a few days before would say, guys, honestly, I have no idea. Even he claims he had no clue whether or not NXT was going to be involved. And at least up to this point, they are not involved. Not a whole lot in the way of surprises on night one, outside of the fact that they have broken up the New Day. Kofi Kingston and Xavier Woods, who returned on SmackDown this week, they are back. They immediately won back the SmackDown tag team titles from Cesaro and Shinsuke Nakamura. Xavier Woods, who has been out of action for one full year. It was a year ago in Australia. He suffered the ruptured or torn Achilles. So 1 year out, he's back. And Kofi Kingston, who's been out since Extreme Rules in July, nursing a back injury, or at least a back injury in storyline, they walk right back in and they take back the tag team titles for the 9th time. It's a 7th SmackDown tag team title reign, 9 tag team titles overall for the New Day. They only need one or two more, I think, to catch up with Harlem Heat, right? We're in Harlem Heat like 10 or 11 time WCW tag team champions. But there you go. The New Day, 9-time tag team champions, the Charlotte Flair of the tag team division. Now, for whatever reason, Raw drafted Kofi and Xavier, but not Big E, who has been a star on the rise on Friday nights ever since this summer. So we are supposed to believe that Raw wanted Kofi and Xavier, but not Big E, which, unless they come up with some kind of explanation for that this week on TV, is dumb beyond words. Not only that, we saw the entire Hurt Business, all 4 members of the Hurt Business, get drafted by Raw. So what was stopping Raw from drafting all 3 of these guys? Nothing. I mean, at least have Big E get drafted first. That would have made some sense, but he went after. None of this makes any sense, but I like the move. I like the move. No, you know what? I love the move. I endorse it. I endorse splitting Big E away from Woods and Kofi. And it really hit me after Big E's Falls Count Anywhere match with Sheamus, which was great. I really enjoyed that match. They actually made use of the stipulation. It was brutal. They beat the hell out of each other. It felt like 2 guys that have had this, you know, beef going now for a couple of months, blowing it off in the best possible way. So I really enjoyed that match. Big E took a lot of punishment. He was all cut up from yet another bump onto a car windshield. How many does that make in the last 3 months, including the parking lot fight on Dynamite? I'm telling you, people, if you are looking for a pandemic-proof industry to join, look for work as a windshield manufacturer. They are doing big business with these wrestling companies over these last 3 months. But after the match, you know, after the match was over, Big E, he was ambushed in the back by Kayla Braxton. For an interview, he's standing there, he looks in pain, he looks exhausted. This is not the happy, jovial Big E, he looks like he has been through a war. And she wants to interview him. That's when Kofi and Woods showed up. They revealed that, hey, we're back. And Big E, you know, he was happy to see them, but they're doing all their usual New Day catchphrases. And Big E, you know, he played along, but it just felt so, in that moment, it felt so out of place. You know, here he had just wrapped up this serious fight. He's bleeding. And now he's spitting out New Day catchphrases. Big E is on his way to single stardom, potentially. He is on his way to single stardom. He does not need Kofi Kingston and Xavier Woods by his side at every waking moment. He doesn't need them. He's proven that over the last couple of months. And I'll even call it now. I see Big E as the men's Royal Rumble winner in 2021. This is a man who is on the ascent. He has been racking up wins. He has been building momentum. The people like him. I think most people, you know, they genuinely want to see him succeed as a single star. I'm one of those people. A Royal Rumble win would send him to that next level, at least temporarily. It sent Shinsuke Nakamura to another level until it didn't, right? Nakamura doesn't feel special at all now. Remember, he won the Royal Rumble a few years ago, and he did get his championship match, he just never could close the deal. But winning the Rumble, it could send you to that next level. What happens at that point is largely up to the booking. But, you know, this could be a career-defining moment for him, if he were to go to the Rumble and win. And he can represent the New Day on the blue brand and let Kofi and Woods rep the group on Monday Night Raw. Now, people have asked me over the years, how would you book the New Day breakup? Would you book the New Day breakup? And I've always said, no, I would not break up the New Day by having one guy turn on the other. Not every group, not every faction, not every tag team has to turn on the other. What is it about professional wrestling where everybody sees the need to turn on each other? I know it's a cutthroat business, but my God. Not everybody has to turn on their brothers or their sisters. I said, at some point, you will want to take a Big E, let's say, and let them branch out into the singles ranks, but they could still be friends. You could just be like, all right, guys, I'm going to go off and do my own thing now. It doesn't have to be, oh, well, Big E deserted us. Fuck him. Let's attack him. So I've never really been behind the idea of breaking up the New Day in terms of, you know, one of them has to go heel and turn on the other. You could do that. I've never really been a fan of that. And that's not what this is. This is just them going their separate ways for the time being. And again, representing Monday night and representing Friday night. That's really what this is. And look, when the time is right, you can always build to the big reunion. There's always the chance to do the big reunion. Unless they have Big E turn on Kofi and Woods on Friday in their farewell match. That I do not endorse. Let me just go on the record and say that. That I do not endorse. But look, why not? Why not take the shot with Big E? If it doesn't work out, then Big E is right back to where he was before. There's no harm in doing it. There's no harm in trying. I see people freaking out. I can't believe WWE broke up the New Day. Typical WWE. Now, WWE does have a tendency to break up, and they did it in this draft too. They've broken up a whole bunch of tag teams. They do this every fucking year. It's just bizarre to me. But it really should come as no surprise if you look at the state of their tag team division right now on Raw and SmackDown. It is in the shitter. This tag team division is dead. There's no reason to have two sets of tag team titles. WWE does not prioritize tag team wrestling. They have a lot of tag team matches on TV, but that doesn't mean they're prioritizing the tag team division. They are not. It is at a low point right now. But I don't look at this as some kind of big egregious move on WWE's part. I got to disagree with all those people freaking out about the New Day breakup. I think it's a good thing. I like the move. Outside of the fact that it doesn't make any sense why Raw wouldn't want to take Big E. I don't know how they're going to explain their way out of that one, but this is WWE, right? They probably don't look at it as we have to explain anything. I don't think they look at it that way. Case in point, Big E on Talking Smack. They had Talking Smack the next morning, and the New Day is on. And they're very dejected, obviously, about being, you know, split up. And they're trying to make the best of a bad situation. They're trying to look at the bright side of it. Sami Zayn was there. He was the guest co-host with Kayla Braxton. And he brought up the fact, what's going to happen now? You're going to have the SmackDown Tag Team Champions going to Monday Night Raw. And Big E is just sitting there, and he just deadpans Sami and goes, how long have you worked for this company? And you're trying to make logic out of this situation? Because Big E doesn't care. I'm watching that thinking, all right, well, let's start the countdown to the next cancellation for Talking Smack. But I thought that was a very good question, actually. Kind of a rhetorical statement on Big E's part. Big E sounds like he's heard a sound off or two in his day when he makes comments like that. But that is the question, though, right? What happens with the SmackDown Tag Team titles? You've just drafted your new SmackDown Tag Champions over to Monday Night Raw. And as much as I would love to see them merge the Raw and SmackDown Tag Team titles, which I have advocated for a long time, as you know, what is going to probably happen is they're not going to merge the titles. They're going to draft the Street Profits to SmackDown tomorrow night. Montez Ford and Angelo Dawkins are in the pool of talent that is eligible to be drafted tomorrow night. Ford's wife, Bianca Belair, she was already drafted to SmackDown. And, you know, the whole husband and wife and breaking up couples thing, they used to do stuff like that all the time. They don't really do as much of that anymore. I think they try to keep the couples together. I don't know what's going to be with Naomi and Jimmy Uso. Naomi is now on Raw. Jimmy is still, I guess, technically on SmackDown. Although he's not back on TV full-time yet. And right now, it's not even that much of an issue because all of the TV is being done out of Orlando. I mean, it's not like one crew is going to this part of the country and the other crew is going to this other part. But WWE does have plans in place to begin touring as early as next month. So they're not going to just be in Florida for that much longer. You know, at some point in the not-too-distant future, their goal is to start traveling to other states and other places. But for the time being, it's less of an issue because they're all flying in and out of Orlando. They're all in one place. They're all at the Thunderdome. So right now, it's not as big of a deal. But I think they're just going to swap the two teams, and they're either going to have them swap their belts, or they're going to create new belts for them to hold. WWE had new SmackDown tag team belts made before WrestleMania 35 last year that still have not been used. That is according to the belt man himself, Belt Fan Dan. They've been sitting unused probably in a warehouse in Connecticut. Maybe they'll finally get around to unveiling those new tag team belts. And if they do, they'll have to make new ones for Raw as well. The other surprise on SmackDown was the return of Lars Sullivan. He's the freak. You know how I know this? Because Michael Cole wouldn't shut up. Corey Graves wouldn't shut up every 2 seconds. The freak, the freak, the freak, Shashik. That should be his theme song. They want you to know that this man is a freak. And he has not been on television since June of last year when he hurt his knee in a match on Raw against the Lucha House Party. And here it was right back to him just showing up and just randomly destroying dudes, just like he was doing the last time we saw him. This time it was Jeff Hardy and Matt Riddle and The Miz. John Morrison backed off. And Lars is part of the eligible pool of talent to be drafted tomorrow night, so they're going to give it a go with old Lars again. I think Raw is the better place for him. I actually think he would fit right in if they're going to keep that Raw Underground shit around, which it sounds like they are. He probably would be a good fit on Raw Underground, you know, killing dudes on there. But I think Raw would probably be a better place for him than SmackDown. So here's how all of the other moves played out. We're going to get into all of this here, including all the people who have yet to be drafted and where I think they should end up and where I think they will end up. But here's how all the other moves played out on Friday. The main champions, they're not going anywhere. Roman Reigns stays on SmackDown. Drew McIntyre stays on Raw. Asuka, the Raw Women's Champion, remains on Monday Night Raw, as do all four members of the Hurt Business, who have been probably the best part of Monday Night Raw for months now. AJ Styles, he's coming back to Monday Night Raw. He returns to the Red Brand, which I predicted last week. I mean, there didn't seem to be any obvious program left for him on SmackDown after the ladder match with Jeff Hardy and Sami Zayn. I'm sure he doesn't mind being away from Paul Heyman. He claims it's not a big deal. He's a professional, but I don't think he's going to cry over being drafted to another brand. Now we just need Heyman to recruit somebody on Raw, like Ricochet, just to fuck with AJ. Heyman could be on both shows. Actually, if Brock ever comes back, he's probably going to be on Raw. So you're going to end up getting Heyman on Raw and Heyman on SmackDown anyway. But I just hope Joseph Park comes with AJ Styles. I hope Joseph Park is part of the package. It would be a sin if we don't get more Joseph Park on TV at some point. And maybe even an Abyss cameo. I thought they would do an Abyss cameo in the Royal Rumble. When did he come into the company? Was it this year? I think it might have been the beginning of this year. Was it this year or last year? I think it was this year. And I thought, okay, I didn't expect Abyss to be wrestling full-time for WWE, but I thought maybe they'd give him a spot in the Rumble match, let him come out in the full like Abyss mask and the whole getup, be like a nice moment. You know, we've had people come over from TNA who were very clearly recognized by the WWE audience, AJ Styles, right? Case in point. So I think he would have gotten a nice little pop for himself, but we never got that. I still think it would be just a nice thing to do. It'd be cool to see him get his moment, and maybe they could even work a spot into the Royal Rumble match with him and AJ. Maybe he dumps AJ out of the ring. I still think there is the potential to kind of just get him a quick cameo at some point. Not the other kind of cameo, because then Vince McMahon would want to take that over. Naomi goes to Raw. MVP was already on Twitter, teasing that the Hurt Business may have an interest. They may have a spot open for their first female member. I'm not so sure that wouldn't be a bad idea. Ditch the glow. I know the glow, that's her whole gimmick. Feel the glow. What the fuck does that even mean? I would consider the offer if I were Naomi. Naomi is part of the Hurt Business. That's kind of intriguing. Shayna Baszler and Nia Jax, the women's tag team champions, they remain on Raw. They'll still be able to float from brand to brand as long as they hold on to those titles. Rick O'Shea, he is staying on Raw. Angel Garza, staying on Raw. I mentioned Kofi and Xavier Woods. They're coming to Monday nights, as are Miz and Morrison. Mandy Rose and Dana Brooke. I have absolutely no idea why they traded for Dana Brooke if they were just going to waste a draft pick on this woman 3 weeks later. I say waste, just, I'm not trying to insult her. I'm just saying, if you are the, we don't have GMs anymore, but if you're the one who's in the war room for this draft, you basically wasted a pick on somebody who you just went and I guess traded for 2-3 weeks ago. It just, it's so dumb. At least the Mandy Rose thing you can explain by saying Miz wanted to get back at Otis and that's why that happened. The Dana thing, though, is just stupid. That is just dumb. Now, SmackDown. SmackDown gets to keep the Tribal Chief, but picks up the other remaining member of the Shield, Seth Rollins, who can no longer sell his Monday Night Messiah shirt. Now he's going by the name of the SmackDown Savior. I believe this is the first time that Rollins, in all these years, all of the drafts that they've had, has ever been drafted as a SmackDown star. He has been a consistent presence on Monday Night Raw since the Shield first debuted in 2012. And that's not to say he hasn't had any matches on SmackDown over the years. He's had some matches, but this is the first time officially, I believe, that he is part of the Blue Brand, which is kind of hard to believe because he's been around for 8 years. And I thought, when I saw that he was drafted SmackDown, I thought, well, at least he's away from the Mysterio family, right? That feud's been going on since, God, I mean, what? How long has that feud been going on for? June? Probably, right? Probably May or June, somewhere around there. But then Rey Mysterio and Dominic Mysterio got drafted to SmackDown as well. So they get to continue their feud on Friday nights. No Aaliyah, though. No mention of Aaliyah. Aaliyah Mysterio. Can Aaliyah be drafted? I mean, she's been on TV now for weeks. No mention of Aaliyah. Sasha Banks stays on SmackDown. Bianca Belair joins her from Monday Night Raw. And that is going to be a sick match one day. Sasha Banks against Bianca Belair. That is a SmackDown Women's Championship main event. At probably not even that far down the road. I could see that just a matter of months. We could be seeing these two women locking it up for the SmackDown Women's title. And I think that would be a hell of a match. Jey Uso stays on SmackDown, as does Otis and Big E. There were several names that went undrafted on Friday night, but they were drafted in the fifth round. They had round five on Talking Smack, which went up on the WWE Network the next morning. Humberto Carrillo. I'm sure everybody was waiting with bated breath. Where is Humberto going to land? Well, Humberto landed exactly where he has been. He's landed on Main Event. Technically, he was drafted by Monday Night Raw, but we all know Humberto was drafted to Main Event. So that is where Humberto will stay. Murphy is going to SmackDown. Back on the same brand with Rollins and the Mysterio family. So again, this whole thing can just continue on. The only thing that changes now is the day of week. We are getting awfully close to Baby Day for Seth Rollins and Becky Lynch. She is due in December, which means that Seth is probably going to be off TV for a little while in the not-too-distant future. So it would be, I think it would be huge for him to put over Murphy on his way out. If Seth is going to be gone for a month, or he's going to be gone for 6 weeks or 8 weeks or whatever it might be, you know, for him to put over Murphy at the end of all this and try to elevate Murphy to that next level, that would be a nice outcome, I think, to all of this. I'd like to see them do that. Drew Gulak goes to Monday Night Raw. Kalisto goes to SmackDown, as I thought would happen. They have split Kalisto away from the Lucha House Party, and there it is, yet another team, another faction, split up. Or at least possibly split up by WWE. I think the other members of the Lucha House Party, well, I'm not sure if they were considered a separate entity. They probably weren't. So they may have already been eligible to be drafted. So I'm going to assume they're staying on SmackDown. Or going to Raw, I should say, because Kalisto's on SmackDown. So I'm not 100% that the Lucha House Party is not going to end up on the same brand, but They probably should. If they're going to give Kalisto a little singles push or something, that's great, but what does it even matter? We all know how this is going to end up. Even if they split away Lince Dorado on his own or they split up Kalisto on his own, they're going to end up on 205 Live. Nothing is going to change. The scenery might change. They might bounce to a different show, but nothing is going to change. Tucker. Staying on the subject of breaking up tag teams, we come to Tucker of Heavy Machinery. Tucker got the bad news when he and Otis were on Talking Smack that Tucker is moving to Monday Night Raw. Otis is staying on SmackDown. Tucker is going to Raw. Otis has now lost Tucker and Mandy Rose. He has lost his tag team partner and best friend and his girlfriend. I mean, I guess they're still boyfriend-girlfriend, but in terms of being on the same brand, he's lost all of the people that are special to him. He's now all alone. And WWE has broken up one of the few remaining teams that they had left. Now, here's my prediction. I don't think this is going to last for long. My prediction is that when Otis's case, the stupid case, which was given a continuance on TV this week, he was supposed to be litigating some kind of case with Miz and Morrison for the money in the bank. This is all nonsense. But they granted a continuance because they probably haven't figured out what the fuck they want to do yet. But my prediction is that when Otis's case goes to trial with Miz and Morrison, he is going to be forced to surrender his money in the bank briefcase in exchange for being traded to Monday Night Raw so that he can be reunited with his peach and he can be reunited with Mandy Rose as well. Or do I have that in reverse? I guess Tucker is not his peach. He could be reunited with his partner and with his girlfriend. I still think Otis and Tucker end up back together. There's no reason to break them up. There is no reason to break up Heavy Machinery. I know Vince McMahon supposedly likes Otis. I don't see there being much in the way of a big singles push in Otis's future. I don't see it. There's no reason yet. It's too soon to be breaking up this team. You barely have any teams as it is. They are more valuable together than they are apart. And I like Otis. I like Tucker too. I don't think Tucker gets enough credit in this team. Splitting them up would be a terrible idea. And I think, you know, once this Money in the Bank stuff is resolved, they'll end up back together. And this Money in the Bank situation is a complete embarrassment. The fact that they clearly had no plan for what to do with that briefcase. The mentality of shoot now, ask questions later. It doesn't work. It has come back to bite them on the ass. They have absolutely no idea what to do with that briefcase. It is very clear that they're just trying to figure out a way to get it away from Otis. And what they've done is they've essentially turned the Money in the Bank concept, at least for this year, into a joke, like the 24/7 title. So that means that the free agents, free to sign anywhere they wish, the people who went undrafted, the last kids in line who didn't get picked for dodgeball, the losers are Mickey James, who is out for a few weeks with a broken nose, Gran Metalik, Lince Dorado, I guess I just answered my own question from before. Gran Metalik and Lince Dorado, they went undrafted, so technically they can sign with whoever has interest in them, and Chad Gable. I say send Mickey to SmackDown, keep Metalik and Dorado on SmackDown, because again, whether you split them up or not, it's not going to matter. They probably should just stay where they are. And send Chad Gable to AEW. Can we do that? Can we draft him over to AEW? Is that possible? An absolute joke of a company that they see no value in Gable other than just doing 2-minute jobs and squashes for other people. I hope he gets drafted right out of this fucking company. As soon as he's free and clear, I hope he just runs as fast as his feet can carry him and gets the hell out of this company. Now, eligible to be drafted from tomorrow night's pool, we've got a long list here. This is the one remaining night of the draft. Here is the pool for Raw tomorrow night. Andrade. I'm guessing Andrade goes wherever Charlotte Flair goes. I think he Could use some fresh scenery on SmackDown, but I really wish they would put him and Zelina Vega back together. Taking his mouthpiece away from him was a big mistake. I think Angel Garza without Zelina is okay. You know, and he can, you know, in terms of promos, he does a better job with the promos. I don't think he necessarily needs a Zelina Vega, but Andrade, I think it just is, it's so much of a stronger act if you just keep the two of them together. And I think it was a big mistake to split them apart. You could put them back together. I would put them back together. Bayley. I believe Bayley is Raw bound. I think Bayley's going to Monday Night Raw. And maybe that does give away the finish at Hell in a Cell. But Bayley has beaten everybody there is to beat on Friday nights. Even if you put a couple of new faces in the women's division on that show, she has been a staple on SmackDown now for a long time. She has held that SmackDown Women's Championship, in fact, for exactly one full year. It was October 11th of 2019 that she regained the SmackDown Women's title from Charlotte Flair. As of today, 365 days later, she is 1 year as the SmackDown Women's Champion. And if you take away the 1 week that Charlotte beat her for the belt, that one little hiccup, that number expands to over 500 days. If you count all the days from the run that came before Charlotte beat her for the belt, over 500 days she has spent as the SmackDown Women's Champion. I really wish they would have tried to hold off and do the title change next year at WrestleMania, if they would have been able to find a way to do that, have Sasha win the Women's Royal Rumble match. I don't see that happening now. I think Sasha will take the title at Hell in a Cell, and I think Bayley moves on. There is nothing left for her to do on SmackDown. And at least for a little while, I think they might want to put some distance between Sasha and Bayley. Aleister Black. I think you could build Aleister Black for a pay-per-view match with Drew McIntyre. I think you can build him up as an opponent for Drew McIntyre in the WWE Championship. It'll take a little bit of work. You know, he doesn't feel like a contender right now, but I think you can get there with him. And frankly, I think that could be a pretty damn good match too. Drew McIntyre against Aleister Black. So I would keep him on Raw. Daniel Bryan is a name that has not been mentioned much recently. He's still on paternity leave. He could be back. Who knows? He could be back any week. But he is in the pool. I think Bryan should stay on SmackDown. I think there is the potential for rematches with Sami Zayn, matches with Big E, matches with Matt Riddle, and yes, matches with Roman Reigns. And boy, is there a history there that they could play off of. That could even be the WrestleMania match. Roman Reigns has a few different options. If he's still the champion come WrestleMania 37, I don't think the match with The Rock is going to happen. I guess you could put that on there as a possibility. I don't see that. You've got The Rock, though, as a possibility. You've got Big E. They want to build Big E up to that point. Big E against the Tribal Chief. And I think Daniel Bryan as well has to be on that list of consideration too, just given the history between these two, and the history that Roman can kind of play off of, and all the shit that he had to go through all those years ago. You know, it's all Bryan's fault, and now look at me and look at you. And Bryan is always a great underdog babyface, and he's been gone long enough where I think, you know, it would kind of, I think that that is a match that people could get behind. I'm not saying that should be the WrestleMania match next year. Bryan has been there. Bryan's already had his shot. If they want to give it to somebody else, I'm okay with that. I just look at these rosters and I like some of the matchups for him on SmackDown. It's not as if he has horrible matchups on Raw. You know, if you wanted to have Daniel Bryan against Aleister Black, Daniel Bryan against Drew McIntyre, Daniel Bryan and Keith Lee. You know, if Keith Lee was to stay on Monday nights. There's a lot of people, I think, that he really has not worked with on both brands. That could be a lot of fun. I would probably keep him on SmackDown. Carmella is eligible. King Corbin, who needs to ditch that gimmick. I mean, my God, it's been over a year of this King nonsense with the crown and the scepter. Enough already. Enough. Are they even doing another King? I guess they're not. I guess they're not doing King of the Ring. They do King of the Ring when it's convenient for them to do King of the Ring. Maybe we'll get one next year. Apollo Crews, all I'm going to say about this is get him the fuck away from the Hurt Business. I don't care where you put him. Hurt Business is on Raw. Put him on SmackDown. You can put him on NXT. You could put him somewhere else. Put him in Ohio Valley Wrestling. I don't give a shit. Just get him away from MVP and the Hurt Business. For the love of God, please. Put him somewhere else. Nikki Cross is eligible. Dabba Kato. Hey, look, it's Yabba Dabba Doo guy. He is eligible in the draft. Dolph Ziggler and Bobby Roode. Eric of the Viking Raiders. Eric of the Viking Raiders, he just had surgery to remove a surgical screw in his arm that was poking into the triceps in his, as he calls it, cyborg arm. I believe that this is some of the hardware that was installed after that motorcycle wreck 6 years ago that almost killed him. I mean, by all accounts, he should have died in that accident. Even the doctor said, the fact that you're alive right now is beyond comprehension. That's how awful that accident was that he was in. I remember that too, because he, you know, War Machine was, you know, they were a big act at the time in Ring of Honor when he had that wreck. And so Ivar Hansen, he got a nice little singles push for himself. I remember being at a couple of those shows, and God, it was one of the shows at Terminal 5 in New York, because they didn't want to pay the rent or whatever it was, the fee to rent out the Manhattan Center, the Hammerstein. So they went to Terminal 5, which is some, you know, dance club. Or it was. For all I know, it could be shut down now with everything going on. But I remember there was some kind of fatal four-way match that he was part of, and I remember being really impressed. So he was getting a nice singles push while Eric was on the shelf for a while there. Look, I hate to say it, but without Ivar's out right now with a neck injury. Without Ivar, Eric is doomed. I just don't see them doing anything with him. This was the right time for him to take some time off and have surgery. You may as well. Right? I mean, God, you may as well. Luke Harper did the same thing. I think when Eric Rowan went down with an injury, he had some kind of nagging injury he had to have taken care of. I think he went off and had surgery for something. It's the perfect time for it. But frankly, even if he comes back in 3 months, 6 months, Ivar's still out, you really think they're going to do anything with Eric? No. No. They're not going to do anything with Eric. Doesn't matter what brand he gets drafted to. They're not going to do anything with Eric. Lacey Evans is eligible tomorrow night. Charlotte Flair, who I would draft to SmackDown. I think her and Bianca could have some good matches together. Jeff Hardy is eligible. Billy Kay. Lana. I think Lana would prefer to be drafted to a show that has no announce table at ringside. Keith Lee. I think Keith Lee stays on Monday Night Raw. Riddick Moss. We've seen Riddick Moss pop up on Raw Underground. Riddick Moss had no idea that he has been wrestling for the past 2 months with a torn ACL. He announced this on his Instagram. So he didn't say he had surgery. I have to assume he had surgery to fix the issue. So if that's the case, he's going to be gone for a while. It depends if it was a partial tear or full tear. He didn't give any details. He'll be gone for at least a few months, I would imagine. If he knew that he was hurt and he worked through it anyway, then he's a moron. I mean, if it was a partial tear, he could have a full tear now. You know, it's like, dude, you know, maybe he just thought it was something minor. That doesn't feel like a big deal. It doesn't hurt all that much. All right, well, then maybe that's different. But when you know, like, oh, shit, something's wrong with my knee, something's wrong with my leg, you got to get that checked out. Guy's wrestling for 2 months with a torn ACL. You mean to tell me he didn't feel any pain? He had no symptoms? He had no lingering issues from that? He seems to take pride in the fact that he wrestled for 2 months without even knowing he had a torn ACL. I don't know if that's bravery or just stupidity. It's not smart either way, because now he's gone. And who knows when he's going to be back. R-Truth, Natalya, Titus O'Neil, Randy Orton, Bray Wyatt. I think they're going to move Bray Wyatt. And WrestleVotes seems to, you know, they kind of already said he's probably moving. I would think they would move Bray Wyatt just to get the Fiend away from Roman Reigns. So I think we have probably seen the last of the Fiend on SmackDown. And that begs the question, what happens with Alexa Bliss? Alexa Bliss is very much part of this whole Fiend act now. This story is not yet done playing itself out. If the Fiend is moved to Monday nights, then Alexa has to come with him. Kevin Owens. I would send Kevin Owens to SmackDown. And SmackDown is where Kevin Owens wants to be. He did an interview with Bleacher Report. He said that he thinks a move to SmackDown would be a change for him that would be good. He thinks it would be a chance at a fresh start. This is what he said. I don't know what it is about me. I feel like I give it my all. I deliver every time I'm on the air. But for some reason, I feel like I always end up in a situation where I could always use a fresh start after a little while. I always try my best to do that, so it always helps to get a new platform. Here I am again, 1 year later, and last year, I was so desperate to move to Raw, and I got moved to Raw. Now I'm pretty desperate to move to SmackDown, because for some reason, I don't feel like things are working out for me on Raw. Maybe I'll be better on SmackDown, but at the same time last year, I didn't think things were working out for me on SmackDown, and I thought Raw maybe was the place. And he said that he was very upset. It bothered him that he got drafted so low. Owens went in the third round in 2019. I do think that Kevin Owens is sort of underappreciated for what he can bring to the table, and I can understand why he would be frustrated. I don't know that things are going to be all that different for him this time around, but I think moving to SmackDown is the right move. Retribution. I'm going to be talking about Retribution here in a little bit. I think they stay together on Raw as an act. I don't think they're going anywhere. Matt Riddle. This is an interesting one. Matt Riddle has been sued by the woman who accused him of rape when he was still working for Evolve. This was an incident that allegedly happened, I think it was 3 years ago. Is it two or three years ago, I believe, is when this is alleged to have taken place. WWE doesn't seem too concerned by this because he was on TV Friday night, and at least so far, there doesn't seem to be any kind of blowback or, hey, let's take him off TV for a while. This could get kind of messy. Everything seems to be kind of all hunky-dory where it comes to Matt Riddle on TV. But this is going to be a cloud that is hanging over his head for a long time. Now, this woman is also suing WWE. She is suing Evolve. And she is suing Gabe Sapolsky. All four of them, she is suing for $10 million each. So that's a $40 million lawsuit that she has filed against all of these parties. I'm not sure how that works, given that WWE now owns Evolve. Evolve no longer stands as its own separate entity. Gabe Sapolsky works now for WWE. Riddle's a weird one. Because I've talked up Matt Riddle in the past. You know, even before, I couldn't understand why WWE wouldn't sign him. They clearly did not want Matt Riddle going anywhere else. They did not want Matt Riddle to go to AEW. They did not. They wanted Matt Riddle in Evolve. And I think it was kind of like Triple H telling Gabe at the time, hey, take this guy. We're not ready for him yet, but we think he could be something. So you take him, because they had the working relationship with Evolve. So clearly there was always an interest there, even if it was just to keep him away from other companies. And then it just got to the point when AEW was starting to bubble up, that's when they signed Riddle, right? Now, it predates the birth of AEW by a little bit, but I think WWE could see that things were starting to happen. And all of a sudden, I think it was in 2018, Riddle gets signed. And he's very good. He's very good. I remember seeing a lot of his independent matches and was very impressed. And I thought to myself, you just look at this guy. This guy has star written all over him. He could be the greatest babyface in the world. I've heard the comparisons made to the Von Erichs, not just because of the bare feet, but, you know, he could be that kind of babyface. And I still think that the potential is there for that. I think he is very talented. But boy, you know, there's been a lot of stories that have come out. There seems to be a lot of people in the wrestling business, a lot of talent that has a lot of heat with Matt Riddle, or Riddle has heat with a lot of different people. Including Seth Rollins, which I found to be very interesting. Seth Rollins got drafted this week to SmackDown. So after Rollins got drafted to SmackDown, he was back doing an interview with some of the hosts, the guys that host that WWE show, The Bump. It was kind of like a watch-along they were doing. And so now Rollins is in the hot seat being interviewed about what it's like to be moved. You're going from Raw to SmackDown. And they're asking him all kinds of questions. And the name Matt Riddle is brought up. And Rollins' exact words were, I've got no interest in facing Matt Riddle at any point in my career, so he could go to Raw as far as I'm concerned. And that was it. And he sounded 100% serious when he said this. Now, from what I can gather, because I thought there's got to be a reason for this. Maybe there's something that happened. From what I can gather, this stems at least in part, this may not be all of it, but it stems at least in part from Riddle's wife, Lisa, body shaming Becky Lynch last year on Instagram. And by the way, I get that Riddle's wife is a personal trainer. She's like a bodybuilder, I think, and a personal trainer. Takes fitness very seriously. But who the hell body shames Becky Lynch? And Becky Lynch was not the only woman on the roster that apparently she was body shaming and talking crap about on social media. But there was a picture. Because even though she deleted the post, the internet never forgets. People took screenshots. And in the screenshot, she had a picture of Becky Lynch's backside. Becky Lynch is standing in the ring, and it's just a picture of her ass. And she writes this long post talking about, like, these women, you got to start squatting. And I'm like, who the hell? Like, really? You're going to body shame Becky Lynch? I mean, not that it would make her any more likable if she was body shaming somebody else. But even I thought, like, wow, that's a weird thing to be doing. That's a very weird thing to be doing. So I'm guessing between that and just the reputation that Riddle seems to have, Seth really does not like Matt Riddle, and he does not want to work with him. The list of people who don't like Matt Riddle and don't want to work with him seems to be getting longer. Brock Lesnar literally told Matt Riddle, I will never work a match with you. Goldberg wants nothing to do with him, because he's been talking crap about Goldberg for years. Now Seth Rollins. Don't forget Tommaso Ciampa. I don't know that Ciampa's ever said that he wouldn't work with Riddle, but remember that video that Riddle put out on Twitter last year? It was like this 20-second video, quick video he posted to Twitter, just looking in the camera. I guess what happened is he was calling out the other people on the NXT roster. He was calling them garbage for not giving him a ride. Their cars, I guess they were going to the next town or whatever. I guess their cars were all just conveniently full, and they refused to give Matt Riddle a ride. So he called them all hags, and he called them all pieces of trash. And Tommaso Ciampa, he tweeted back, and he said, the boys will police themselves. Go fuck yourself. That was his message for Matt Riddle. And look, it's not, you know, we can look back on it a year later. It's not like it was some kind of angle that led to a match. I don't even think Ciampa was back on TV yet. I think he had just made his return a few weeks after that. But yeah. Yeah, he had the very curt reply to Matt Riddle, telling him to go fuck himself. So it just seems to me like there's a lot of people. And from what I understand, those are not the only names. There are quite a few people who are not very fond of Matt Riddle. And at some point, you start to wonder if it's the people that are the problem, or is it the person? Right? Because you don't have to get along with everybody. You don't have to get along with all of your coworkers. But it's one thing to not be, you know, to have some kind of beef with one, two people. When there's multiple stories about this, you start to wonder, who is the real problem in this scenario? Why is it that all these people seem to have an issue with this one guy, right? What's going on here? And I'm sure having a rape charge hanging over your head now doesn't help matters either. The Riot Squad is eligible tomorrow night. Ruby Riott and Liv Morgan. Peyton Royce. Arturo Hua. Or Huas. Sami Zayn is eligible. Sami Zayn is the Intercontinental Champion. We know Bobby Lashley is the United States Champion. The Hurt Business is staying on Raw. I don't see Sami coming to Raw with the IC title. I think he stays right where he is, which means that we may soon see him and Kevin Owens. If Kevin Owens moves over to SmackDown, we may soon see the two of them mixing it up yet again in the ring. I think enough time has probably gone by where I'd be okay to see it. I just got so sick of it after a while. They needed to keep these guys apart for a while, and they have. But they always just seem to find their way back to each other. It's like they said all those years ago, we're destined to do this forever. I think that's true. I actually believe that to be true. They always seem to find their way back to each other. Sheamus. Sheamus has feuded with Jeff Hardy. He has feuded with Big E. He has lost both of those feuds. And his good buddy, his good friend, Drew McIntyre, happens to be the WWE champion on Monday Night Raw. I'm thinking Sheamus is going on Monday Night Raw. I think he would be someone they can plug in there for at least one pay-per-view match with McIntyre, somebody for McIntyre to beat. Shinsuke Nakamura and Cesaro are eligible tomorrow night, as are the Street Profits, who I believe are going to move to SmackDown. Braun Strowman, Tamina, Akira Tozawa, and Zelina Vega. I think where Andrade goes, so should Zelina Vega. But I expect her to stay on Raw. If that's where Aleister Black stays, then she'll probably stay on Monday Night Raw. So that is where we are with the draft. Those are the moves I would make. I think it's a mistake. I have to say this. I think it is a mistake to not include NXT in these things, even if just for appearance purposes. Even if a lot of people don't really go back and forth to the NXT brand, to not even have them as part of this draft process. Like, once the show was moved to USA Network, there was no longer any excuse to not treat NXT like the third brand they keep telling us that it is. It's almost like they treat it like a third-rate brand. Oh, it's not developmental, Triple H says. It's our third brand. They sure don't treat it like one. You know, NXT was included in last year's Survivor Series. The NXT stars were all over Raw and SmackDown for weeks leading up to Survivor Series. And then they went to Survivor Series and they won. NXT won. Please justify to me why they shouldn't be included in this draft. If they were, I would have probably sent Johnny Gargano and Candice LeRae to SmackDown. I would like to see Rhea Ripley on SmackDown, but with Io Shirai and Toni Storm and now Ember Moon in that NXT women's division, I think she can stick around there for a little while longer. They have refreshed the women's division down in NXT. And it's not just a one-way street. You know, NXT could have used a few pickups too. Chad Gable, yes, I want to see Chad Gable leave and go somewhere else. But if the guy can't go anywhere for a while, if he's locked up for a while, I would send him back to NXT and see if he can get things back on track. Ditch the fucking name. Ditch the fucking gear. And try to get his career back on track. I do think that he brings value. Whenever I defend Chad Gable, there's always a few morons who I don't even think really listen to the show, but they'll hear clips and they'll be like, oh, all he does is you defend Chad Gable. The guy's a jobber. What do you see in Chad Gable? He's tiny. He's a vanilla midget. If you can't see the fact that Chad Gable brings value or could bring value to the show, then you never saw his run in NXT. But just go back and watch the King of the Ring last year. He and Baron Corbin had a great King of the Ring last year. And Chad Gable was the great underdog babyface story of the entire tournament. He had people who probably didn't even know who he was in some cases. When he would come out, sometimes it would be crickets. By the end of the match, they would be behind this guy. They were rooting for him. They wanted to see him succeed and win and do well. He has that innate ability to get people behind him. He is very strong for a guy who is on the smaller side. So when you watch him, you know, roll up somebody and throw him in the air like a Baron Corbin, who is a big guy, and throw him in the air with a Chaos Theory or something, he can pop you with those big moves. He's got the Olympic background. He's very good in the ring. If you don't think this guy doesn't bring value, then you've got cataracts in your eyes. You don't hear me sitting here saying, put Chad Gable in the WrestleMania main event. Put the Universal title on Chad Gable. That's not what I'm saying. Okay? Pay attention to what I'm saying. Don't hear what you want to hear. Pay attention to what I'm actually saying. He can bring value to the product, and it doesn't seem like they agree. Yeah, they gave him a job. They have him under contract, but so what? They signed people for the hell of it. They signed people to keep them away from other companies and from going somewhere else. The real indication that they see value in you is what they are doing with you, if anything, on TV. Clearly, they see no value in this man. And I think that is a flawed opinion. That is fucking stupid. Yes, he brings value. I'd like to see them do something with him, and maybe going back to NXT for a while is exactly what he needs to get back on track. And that would be good enough, right? Finn Balor, they still have Finn Balor. They just got Ember Moon back. That's all you would need to do. You don't need a lot of NXT moves back and forth, but you gotta make them part of the draft. Now, I got an email from Tracy in Brooklyn, and he touched on something that I agree with, and I had wanted to talk about this, and I'm glad he sent the email. And I've talked about this in years past when it comes to the timing of these drafts. Doing a draft in October does not make any sense. It's not even a sweeps period for TV networks. I think that's in November. In February and May. That's usually when sweeps are. That's a very important period for the networks. We're not even in sweeps period yet. So I don't want to hear, well, they do it in October for the ratings. Well, yeah, they do it for the ratings, but you could do it in some other month for the ratings. Doing it in October does not make any sense. The biggest reason is that you are right in the middle of certain feuds. It's one of these times of year where you're right in the middle of a lot of these different feuds and storylines. And sometimes that can be a good thing, right? Sometimes these storylines and these programs are not very good, and you're looking for a reason to just terminate them and move on. So that could be a good thing sometimes. But now you're interrupting these storylines because one person was drafted to another show. A month later, you have Survivor Series. Next month is Survivor Series, which they will bill as this great battle for brand supremacy, Raw versus SmackDown. It's a battle between the red shirts and the blue shirts. Well, if I'm somebody who spent 2 years on Monday Night Raw, and then I get drafted to SmackDown, 4 weeks later, I mean, how loyal can I really be to the blue brand, right? But I've argued that something has to be on the line. That's always been my biggest gripe with this. Something has to be on the line if you're going to do this. And this, by the way, this is just a separate point. This has nothing to do with the timing of the draft, but I wanted to bring this up as well. Since I mentioned Survivor Series and the whole brand supremacy thing, it's always bragging rights. Why do I give a shit? I'm not on Raw. I'm not on SmackDown. I watch both shows every week. I have no loyalty to one brand over the other. I don't give a shit. Something should be on the line, more than just brand supremacy and bragging rights. They used to have a pay-per-view called Bragging Rights. You know why they don't have a pay-per-view called Bragging Rights anymore? Because nobody bought the fucking show. If it was a concept that worked, they would still be doing Bragging Rights every single year. Nobody cares about that. There needs to be something at stake. Something tangible has to be on the line. There have to be real stakes at Survivor Series in order to get people to really care about who wins. And Tracy pitched an idea that I've also pitched in the past. What if you did the draft right after Survivor Series? And the winning brand earned bonus picks in the draft. Or even better, the winning brand earned the number one pick in the draft. You could exclude the top two champions if you want to, because, you know, if you included NXT, for example, I don't think anybody believes that Roman Reigns is going to NXT. If I'm Triple H, I would want to draft Roman Reigns to NXT. So let's say you exclude the two top champions, right? You could do that if you want to. But at least if you do it this way, then there's something tangible on the line. Now, the other time that would make the most sense to do the draft is when they used to do it, which is right after WrestleMania. WrestleMania has, not always, but traditionally, been the place where feuds reach their climax. It sort of represents the end of the WWE season, and Raw the next night represents the start of the new season. That's the perfect time to hold a draft, when you have a whole bunch of stories that have already wrapped up, and now you can refresh the rosters and start a whole bunch of new stories that take you through the rest of the year. So those are my thoughts on the draft, the timing of the draft, and all the eligible picks in the pool tomorrow night. We will see how it shakes out on Raw. Do I see a radical shift in these shows coming out of the draft? Not a radical shift. It never really feels like things change all that much. But, you know, sometimes if you have a couple of big moves, you know, that could kind of freshen things up for at least a few weeks. But they're going to have to address some of these questions that I mentioned. And the stuff about the Big E thing, again, it's just very puzzling to me why Raw would pick two members of the New Day and not all three. And I'm not going to hold my breath, but I'm hoping that they'll have some kind of explanation for it on TV this week. I was going to say, maybe we come to find out that Big E actually put in a request for it, but that's not how he's been behaving, like a family member died. So unless he's swerving everybody, I don't think it's going to be that. I don't know that we're going to get any explanation. But again, all the people who are pitchforks and torches coming after WWE for splitting up the New Day, I think you need to take a step back and think about this a little bit harder. This is a good move. This is a positive move. And the worst thing that happens is the Big E singles push. It doesn't go as far as some people think it's going to go, and the New Day ends up right back together where they were before. It is a win-win situation. I like the move. There is nothing really new to report on the WWE Twitch cameo situation outside of one report that talent is said to be very mad, as you would expect them to be about the whole situation. Paige did raise some eyebrows this past week when she tweeted a very vague statement saying that she learned a lot about unions today. I'm sure she's not the only one, but there's a difference between reading about it and actually doing anything. And to this point, nobody has done anything. Nobody has stood up and said anything about this publicly or even behind the scenes, at least not as far as some of the sites have reported. They may be very upset and very angry about this, but nobody is actually standing up and doing anything so far. But I bring this up because in light of this, I found this next item to be so rich. So rich and so creamy and so sweet that it almost gave me a cavity. At the same time the WWE was taking control last week of the Twitch and the Cameo accounts for its talent, Forbes magazine published its list of the world's most influential chief marketing officers, and guess who ranked number 2 on the list, right below the senior vice president of worldwide marketing for Apple? Stephanie McMahon came in at number 2 on the list, and hey, that's a great position for her to be in, right under the guy from Apple. But get a load of the description that accompanied her entry on this list. This was the write-up. McMahon is an outspoken and highly visible executive at WWE, a company in an industry often mired in controversy. The daughter of WWE CEO Vince McMahon, she is a former WWE superstar herself, and she is a big proponent of WWE superstars growing their own brands via social media. I'll bet she is. They're a big proponent of growing your own brands on social media so that they can take them over. Hey, I'd be a big proponent of that too. You do all the work and then I get to take over. Of all the weeks for that list to be published, I don't think I can make this shit up if I tried. The big news coming out of Raw Monday night was the reveal of Mustafa Ali as the leader of Retribution. That is according to WWE. They are referring to him now as the leader. Now, let me be the first to say, it is nice that Ali is going to finally get a bit of a push for the first time since being brought back to TV. He was off television for 7 months for no good reason. Then they brought him back with no plan, and he has spent much of his time wrestling on Main Event. But him being put with Retribution does not suddenly make Retribution a good thing. That is going to be up to WWE. Where they take the story next. Ali is going to get his first promo on Raw tomorrow night. It is being promoted that Ali will speak, and that's going to be very important. It's going to be an important promo to see how they explain things, or even if they, you know, how deep they really choose to even go into the story. Ali was having a match with MVP when Retribution came out. MVP asked Ali, hey, are you going to stand with us? And Ali was standing with the Hurt Business initially, but then he confronted T-Bar and Mace in the aisle before telling them to get him. He pointed at the Hurt Business and told Retribution to go get them, and they did. And after they laid out MVP, Lashley, and Shelton Benjamin, again, there was no Cedric Alexander this week, Ali stood with them in the middle of the ring as Samoa Joe wondered on commentary, how long has he been with the group for? And it's a shame, because Ali is such a great babyface to root for. And now, I mean, look, I don't even know if I can, I won't call it a heel turn yet. It probably is, but I will not call this a heel turn. I don't think you can yet call this a heel turn. Even though these people have been terrorizing everybody in the company, including the announcers and the people in the production truck, and they've taken weapons and chainsaws and, you know, all kinds of hell. Right, that this group has been raising now for weeks and weeks. I don't know that I would call this a heel turn yet for Ali. I mean, they attacked the Hurt Business. The Hurt Business is positioned as a heel group. on Monday Night Raw. So I won't go that far yet, but heel turn or not, this is not the underdog babyface Mustafa Ali anymore. That is now dead for the time being. And so this could be a big break for him. Now, unfortunately, it comes as part of this terrible storyline. Terrible so far. There's still time to turn things around. And the way that I would do that is I would have Ali explain very easily. It's very, very simple. I would have Ali explain how he has been taken for granted and he has been overlooked time and time again by WWE management for the past 2 years. I would take it all the way back to last year's Elimination Chamber, when he was supposed to be in the Elimination Chamber match, and he was taken out of the match after Randy Orton stomped on his face in their match on TV, and I think it was a broken orbital socket. He injured Ali. Ali had to be removed. And in his place, the substitute was Kofi Kingston. And Kofi went on to have this great story heading into WrestleMania, and he got his WrestleMania moment, and he became the WWE champion. Now, I am not saying that would have been Mustafa Ali. I don't believe that Mustafa Ali was going to WrestleMania to win the WWE championship, although he could have potentially competed for it. I don't think he was winning anything. But he would have at least had some kind of a match or a spot, I'm sure, on the show. He had a little bit of momentum at that time. I think people liked Ali and they were starting to get behind him. And, you know, he's a likable guy. And who knows what spot he would have ended up in at WrestleMania. But Kofi got the spot. Kofi has been there a lot longer than Mustafa Ali. He's been there for however many years, 11 years, I think it was. And the people just got behind him. You can't really ever predict how or when the people are going to get behind somebody like that, like they did with Daniel Bryan. It just sort of happens. It happens organically. There's a reason for it. They feel sorry for the guy, or they think he's been getting screwed over. They think he's been overlooked. He's really talented. Let's get behind this guy. But you can never really predict. It's like when something goes viral on social media, right? Everybody wants to go viral. If you are trying to go viral, you will not go viral. Going viral is just something that happens. You can't really predict it. You don't know. You can't say when it's going to happen. It just sort of happens. But Ali lost his spot in the chamber. It was taken away from him. And all he has to do is draw back to that and say, well, what about me? What about my WrestleMania moment? They're already teasing something with Ali tweeting, "Hello, Kofi," after Kofi got drafted to Monday Night Raw. The story is right there. Retribution has its next target. Even though it would really make more sense for Ali to go after Randy Orton. I mean, Kofi didn't have anything to do with him getting hurt. It was Randy Orton. But have him bring that up, and then have him talk about the fact that they kept him sidelined for 7 months. I don't think he was hurt. They just didn't have anything for him. They kept him sidelined. 7 months of his career, gone. 7 years of his prime, gone. Only to bring him back and keep him down. You can easily explain why Ali would have a reason to want retribution on WWE. They could even tie in the hacker stuff if they wanted to. A lot of people thought Ali would end up being the hacker, right? It was the symbol on his glove. He was off TV at the time. It's got to be Ali. It's Mustafa Ali. Everybody convinced themselves. And I thought it was him too, but everybody convinced themselves it was Mustafa Ali. Maybe it was supposed to be him. Maybe it wasn't. Maybe we'll never find out. Maybe it'll go down like GTV. But if they wanted to, if that was supposed to be him, they could tie the hacker stuff in to this too. That would at least explain the flickering lights in the buildings that we've been seeing. That doesn't explain the awful camera work, which is one of the things that needs to stop. They need to stop with the cameramen shaking the camera up and down. Do you know how ridiculous that would look? And actually, they got caught once. I don't remember when this was, but they got caught in the last, like, I don't know, last couple of years. It was on an episode of Raw. Somebody who was in the audience that night took film with their phone, and they got caught. They caught one of the cameramen. He's standing there. He's got the camera on his shoulder, and he's just bobbing up and down. The guy looked like he was having a seizure. You know how ridiculous that looks? That's what they do. When they come out and they do the shaky cam stuff, they have one of the cameramen stand there and literally just shake the camera up and down. And somebody thinks that this is actually a good television technique to use on this show. Maybe in some movie scenes it works. But to do it every time Retribution comes out and to do it for these segments on Raw and SmackDown, it is absolutely abominable. The worst production of any show on television that I've seen. These fucking guys, they got fucking, it's like they got AirPods in their ears. They're headbanging while they're bobbing the camera up and down. They're jamming down to Def Leppard. It doesn't add to the sense of urgency. It doesn't make things seem more chaotic. It just makes people physically ill. And they need to stop doing that. Now, they may have dropped the hacker stuff when they realized that they wanted to use Ali for this angle. But to believe that would mean that they knew Ali would be revealed as the leader a few months ago, and that's probably giving these people too much credit. It's more likely that Vince McMahon probably wandered into the building at 2 o'clock in the afternoon last Monday, and Ali got the news a few hours later that, hey, we decided you're going to be in Retribution. That I can believe. But now he is. He is now the leader of Retribution. And the key, as always, is going to be in the follow-up. This angle on Monday means nothing if the follow-up is not any good. Or if they just break them up in the draft, which I don't think they will. I think they'll keep them together. We'll find out tomorrow night. Ali has a logical reason for wanting Retribution. Dio Madden has a reason for Retribution if they want to call back to that run that he had for all of 2 months as an announcer on Monday Night Raw. Remember Vic Joseph and Dio Madden were the new Raw announce team, and they put Jerry Lawler with them because they wanted, I guess, some veteran voice in there to help them out. Oh, Lawler, we're going to bring Lawler back on a temporary basis. That was the story at the time. Lawler ended up being a lot more than just temporary. So, you know, Dio, he wasn't an announcer. He was a wrestler. He had been in developmental for a number of years. He certainly looks the part. He's a big dude. He can be a big, scary-looking guy. But he never really had a chance to grow as an announcer because the experiment was over in 2 months. And how did the experiment end? Brock Lesnar gave him an F5. He was standing up. I think he was standing up trying to help Jerry Lawler. And for his troubles, he got F5'd and put through the announce desk. And we never saw or heard from him on TV again. Not until he started popping up in the audience on these Raw Underground segments. Dominik Dijakovic, I brought up the Keith Lee stuff from NXT where Karrion Kross left Dijakovic for dead. And that was Karrion Kross's way of kind of getting back at Keith Lee. I'm going to kill your friend. I'm going to kill your brother. And that image of Keith Lee in the ring kneeling down beside Dijakovic's dead body, it was like the whole Rocky IV thing with Apollo Creed. Ali, he even alluded to some of these things in a tweet. It was a collage of images, and it was one from, it had an image of Ali reaching up, almost winning the Money in the Bank briefcase. I think that was before Brock Lesnar came out and pushed him off the ladder, and then he won. In the collage, he showed the image of Dio being F5 by Brock through the table. Boy, it sounds like Retribution should probably be going after Brock Lesnar, doesn't it? I don't think Brock could keep a straight face in the ring with some guy called Slapdick. I don't think he could do it. He could barely keep it together when he was in the ring with R-Truth. You think he's going to keep it together with Slapdick? Or Slapnuts or Slapjack or whatever the fuck his name is? But the stories are there. Even Shane Thorne, old Slapjack. In this tweet that Ali put out, there was a small image in this collage of Shane Thorne on Raw in the backstage area earlier this year with MVP. That was when they put Shane Thorne and Brendan Vink from NXT. They put them with MVP for what, 2 weeks before they disappeared from TV? If they actually pay attention, and I had forgotten about that, but if they actually pay attention to some of the details here, and they kind of weave this into the story, which I don't believe was their original plan. This all sounds well and good, and maybe they'll actually do it. I don't believe for a second that when this angle was conceived of all these months ago, they had all the pieces in place. Oh, we're going to tie in the whole Brendan Vink and Shane Thorne thing and the Dio Madden thing. They don't think like this. I think a lot of this, frankly, is the fans and podcast hosts and people like that trying to make sense of all this, trying to piece things together. That's what I think is really going on here. Maybe it's the fans just letting their imagination run wild. Maybe it's the fans trying to give the company more credit than it deserves. All I'm saying is the story is there. If they want to explain it on TV, the story is there. And it could be at least a cool explanation, instead of just wondering why these people started randomly attacking all the members of the roster. We need to hear from these people now. It's time. It's been a few months. The time has come. These stupid promos they've been doing, fucking the Bane wannabe over here, all the cliched language and stuff that some fucking writer put on a piece of paper for them, fuck that shit. They need the real kind of money promo to put the exclamation point on this, and maybe Ali could be the one to deliver that on behalf of the whole group. Maybe we'll get that promo from Ali tomorrow night. It's not enough to just say that Ali is part of Retribution. We need to know the why. Because if not, if the plan here is not to really give Ali a push as a single star, then for Ali, this is just a temporary thing for him to do. It's not really going to matter. But, you know, this also is not just about Ali. They called up a whole bunch of people from NXT. This is supposed to be the start. It's like the start of their second career. They had a career for themselves, kind of, right, in developmental or on NXT. And now this is supposed to be their big push. This is supposed to be their big moment. This is not just about Ali. The goal should be to get over T-Bar and Mace and you know, Retaliation or Reckoning or whatever the fuck their names are. That should be the real goal here as well, is to get some of these people over. And I still worry that in this gimmick, it's just going to be a dead end. Unless they, you know, change their look up or do something different, this is still in jeopardy of going down a very bad road. And it could be a very uphill, you know, climb for a lot of these new talents if they kind of go down the wrong path. And so for their sake, I hope they can salvage this. I hope they could turn this into something positive. I don't want to see their career stalled because of some stupid idea from creative that they didn't give enough thought to. Mercedes Martinez might not even be part of this angle anymore. Mercedes Martinez is no longer listed on the Raw roster. She's not been really mentioned in any of this. It sounds like, and PW Insider even confirmed it, but I mean, it sounds like she's being sent back down to NXT, is what it sounds like. And boy, if that's the case, if I were Mercedes Martinez right now, and she is no longer part of Retribution, she's going back to NXT, I would be doing the Balki Bartakamus dance of joy at that news. Imagine getting that news. We are rescuing you from Monday Night Raw and bringing you back to NXT. It's like a rescue scene out of an action movie. Her in that Retribution mask on TV was like the proof of life video that Triple H needed before he sent the cavalry in to rescue this woman. She should be thanking her lucky stars if she's not part of this Retribution storyline. Now, also on Raw last Monday, Randy Orton challenged Drew McIntyre to a Hell in a Cell match. There it is, one more match for the title. And this time, none of the legends can get involved. Unless Big Show hides under the ring again like he did when he debuted in that cage match with Austin and McMahon. He comes up through the bottom of the ring. Short of that, there will be no interference this time. Lana got put through a table, not just any table, the announce table, for the third straight week by Nia Jax. It has now become a meme. She is a meme. If there is a lesson to be learned here, if your wife still works for the other company, maybe don't go on TV on the other channel and tell your former boss to shove a brass ring up his ass. Maybe that's the lesson to be learned here. We had the Apollo 15 launch, which went about as well as the first 14 did. Crashed and burned. The 15th straight match that Apollo Crews has had with a member of the Hurt Business. This time it was Apollo and Ricochet against Lashley and Shelton Benjamin, with Apollo tapping out to the Hurt Lock. We know Ricochet and the Hurt Business are staying on Monday Night Raw. Apollo Crews needs to be somewhere else. I don't care if it's SmackDown. I don't care where it is. He needs to be far, far away. Because I don't think that NASA or Space Force or whatever the fuck they're calling it these days, I don't think they can afford any more of these mission failures. So he's got to move away. Seth Rollins demanded that Murphy apologize to him. I'm the Messiah, you're the disciple. Murphy had wanted Rollins to apologize to Rey Mysterio's daughter for all that he had done airing those private text messages the week before. Murphy finally stood up for himself. He attacked Rollins. He beat on him with a kendo stick until he apologized to Aaliyah. And he complied. When Murphy dropped the stick, Rollins gouged his eye. And then Rollins was taking the stick to Murphy. He grabbed a chair. Aaliyah came down to protect Murphy. The whole Mysterio family came out. Dominic came out. Rey Mysterio came out. Angie came out. I love how the whole family just travels together to the shows now every week. The best way, if I'm Rey Mysterio and I want to protect my daughter, not only do I want to protect my daughter from Seth Rollins and being injured, I want to protect my daughter from falling for a 32-year-old man. If I want to protect my daughter, the best thing I could do is tell her to stay home. I get that she's 19 and she can make her own decisions, but it's not that hard to, you know, oh, your plane ticket's on the table, and then it's really not, right? And then the family leaves, they go to the airport, and poor Aaliyah is home all by herself. Just leave your daughter home. Why do you keep bringing her to the buildings if you're so worried about her? What kind of father is Rey Mysterio? This family does not approve of Aaliyah helping Murphy. Aaliyah, as far as I know, has no contract. She shouldn't even be there. Just leave her at home. And Randy Orton, Dolph Ziggler, and Bobby Roode beat Drew McIntyre and the Street Profits. McIntyre wiped out Ziggler and Roode with a pair of claymores, and Orton hit Drew with the RKO for the win. I believe that may have been the first time that Drew McIntyre has been pinned since he won the championship at WrestleMania. They have protected him the way that they sort of protected Kofi Kingston last year. He was very well protected. He lost very few, if any, matches for months, even tag team matches, after he won that championship. So Orton pinning him here kind of felt like a big deal. And it's a win that he needed because he has not had many of them lately. And he's the man challenging for the title at Hell in a Cell. Now tomorrow night, it is night two, the final night of the draft. They're having a dual-branded battle royal to determine the next challenger for Asuka's Raw Women's title, which is very odd because if someone were to be, you know, if they were drafted to SmackDown and then they won the battle royal, well, that's kind of stupid. Kevin Owens will also be facing Aleister Black in a no disqualification match. And since I suspect that they're probably ending up on separate brands, this could be the blow off between these two tomorrow night. SmackDown on Friday, just a few other notes. I really liked that false count anywhere match between Sheamus and Big E. They took advantage of the stipulation. They fought through the backstage area into the parking garage at the Amway Center. Big win for Big E. Sami Zayn on Talking Smack made the point that at one point they were fighting in the hallway and Big E told the referee to get out of the way. And he was a little menacing when he said that. But Sami said that when he told the referee to get out of the way, he found Big E to be terrifying. I don't know if I would use the word terrifying, but you knew that he meant business, and it was nice. It was a kind of a side of Big E that hopefully we'll get to see more of. I mentioned the Lars Sullivan return earlier. I already talked about that. I think he's better suited for the Raw brand. Sasha Banks was getting her SmackDown Women's Championship shot against Bayley on this show. They gave this match away. It wasn't even a match. It was more of an angle to set up the rematch that you knew was coming. Bayley used a chair. She got herself disqualified about 2.5 minutes into the match. Sasha beat on her with the chair. Bayley escaped. And so now it's going to be Hell in a Cell for the SmackDown Women's title. Sasha Banks against Bayley. I still say you could headline. You can main event Hell in a Cell with that match. That match could and probably should go on last. It's going to be that or the Roman Reigns match. I don't believe it's going to be Drew and Orton. It's going to be one of those two SmackDown matches, I think, headlining just like Clash of Champions. But I thought this whole segment, I thought this was completely unnecessary. There was already plenty of reason to put these two women inside the cell. You didn't have to put them out there for a two-minute segment like this. But now it's official, and I think we're going to get a new champion is what I think. Although I should hold off on my final predictions. We'll do a prediction stream in a couple of weeks when we get closer to the pay-per-view. But this means we're getting three Hell in a Cell matches on pay-per-view for the first time in 4 years. Three Hell in a Cell matches in one night. Sasha and Bayley, Drew and Orton, and Roman Reigns will be facing Jey Uso, which according to Roman is going to be the first time ever an I Quit match inside the Hell in a Cell. And this time when Jimmy Uso tries to save his brother, he won't be able to get inside. He'll be locked out. Towels don't fit through the cell. He won't be able to throw one in this time, and this should be where Jey is reduced to a bloody mess. Maybe they were saving the blood for Hell in a Cell. It would make sense, right? If he's trapped inside the cage, Jimmy can't get inside, all he can do is watch. He's begging his brother to say, I quit, he won't do it. He's just got the blood all over his face. Could be a great visual. Could be a good time to do it. New Day winning the tag team titles back from Cesaro and Shinsuke. Just felt like a rush job. Nothing built up at all. These two guys came back that night. They came back that night. They've been gone for months. And then they get a tag team championship match and they win the belts back. It was like, we gotta get these belts on these guys real quick. And that's how it felt. And then we had The Fiend wrestling his first TV match ever on SmackDown, beating Kevin Owens. A decisive win for The Fiend. It was a competitive match, but a decisive win in the end. I think these two are swapping brands tomorrow night. The lights went out when they came back on. Alexa Bliss was face-to-face, face-to-mask with The Fiend on the stage. She has to move with him. They've got to keep the story going. There's got to be some kind of a payoff or a resolution here. Where is this going? So wherever Bray goes, so goes Alexa. This Friday is being billed as the season premiere of SmackDown with Roman Reigns defending the Universal Championship. They claim it's the first Universal title defense on SmackDown ever. And he's defending the championship against Braun Strowman. And it's New Day's farewell to SmackDown. They're teaming together to take on Sheamus, Cesaro, and Shinsuke Nakamura. Hey, to me, the bigger story here is not the New Day's farewell match. It's the reunion of the bar. The bar is back together, if only for one night. This Wednesday is the anniversary episode of AEW Dynamite, even though last week technically was the one-year anniversary of their debut on TNT. Dynamite anniversary this Wednesday. You can join me, as is the case every week, live on YouTube immediately after the show for a full recap and quick reaction. Jon Moxley defends the AEW Championship against Lance Archer. I think Moxley retains. I think he holds on to that title at least through Full Gear next month. We don't know who he's going to face there if he makes it that far. I don't see a title change happening this week. FTR defend the AEW Tag Team titles against Best Friends. I've got FTR retaining. Cody puts his newly won TNT title on the line against Orange Cassidy. I'm picking Cody, but this is no guarantee. I don't count out Orange Cassidy. He already lost once for this title to Brody Lee. But I think he's got a chance. He's got a decent chance this time. Who knows? Maybe with an unexpected assist from Brody Lee. Getting revenge on Cody by interfering and maybe cost him the bell. Who knows? I still think Cody is going to retain, though. I got to pick him to win. And just added, Hikaru Shida puts her AEW Women's Championship on the line against Big Swole. All right, I've got to take issue with their whole ranking system here. I got to get on my soapbox here for a second. So Swole is ranked at number 2. Nyla Rose is actually number 1 in the women's rankings. Now in the past, I think it was Tony Khan actually. It might have been Tony Khan himself, who tried to explain how this whole ranking system is going to work. And I think he talked about the quality of wins. The quality of their wins is also what makes a difference in terms of where people rank and who gets a shot when. We have not seen much of Nyla at all on TV recently. And whether or not you're a Nyla Rose fan is kind of irrelevant. They put Vicky Guerrero with her. They made a big deal about, oh, I'm going to have a new manager. And it turned out to be Vicky Guerrero. If this woman has had 5 minutes of television time in the months since she revealed Vicky Guerrero to be her manager, I would be stunned. I'm not aware of there being any kind of injury. just seems like a very odd thing to build up, and then you can't find time on television for this person, who is ranked number one in the women's rankings. Even though she has a better record than Swole has, she has not been on TV. Swole has wins on TV recently. She beat Britt Baker at All Out. So at the pay-per-view, she got a win. She beat Serena Deeb on TV last week. So by that logic, by the whole quality of wins, I get it. That does make sense. But they have done a piss-poor job of explaining this to fans on TV. It can be very confusing. If you pay attention to this sort of thing and you look at the chart, you're wondering, well, why is Swole getting the shot? What happened to Nyla? AEW has to do a better job of explaining these rankings on Dynamite. It's not enough to just mention them in passing or even just put the graphic up on the screen for 10 seconds, which they don't always do. Take the time to just explain it a little bit better, because it can, to a lot of people, it can be very confusing. It's great that Tony Khan or the Bucks or whoever it was took the time in an interview months ago to explain this, but I don't recall them ever really explaining this on Dynamite. And if you have a ranking system, I'd like to see them take it seriously and actually mention it more often. So that's something I think they need to address, not just on social media or on the website, but address it on Dynamite. NXT. Very excited that NXT is bringing back Halloween Havoc. They made the announcement this past week. I guess they finally got the rights to the friggin' name. It took them long enough. They've made use of a few of the old WCW staples, or I guess NWA in some cases, right? That's how far back War Games goes. War Games, Great American Bash, Starrcade. They've used Starrcade for some house shows. But they've never used Halloween Havoc, and I can never understand why. It's such a great name. It's such a great gimmick. It's just the perfect gimmick to use around Halloween season, even if it's not a pay-per-view. Do a TV special, right? I always said, like, have a Halloween Havoc edition of Raw or something. Everybody gets dressed up. Everyone's all festive. Have some kind of Halloween-type stipulation for the main event. And they've never done it. And I think it has more to do with the rights issue, trademarks, and copyrights. Well, now we're getting an NXT version of Halloween Havoc. Leave it to Triple H. Leave it to Triple H to bring back these things. He's brought back War Games. Now he's brought back Halloween Havoc. And it's going to be hosted by Shotzi Blackheart. It's basically just going to be a regular episode of NXT. I would imagine they'll promote some big matches for the show. They have not announced anything yet outside of Shotzi being the one to host the Halloween Havoc episode. I'll probably still be reviewing Dynamite on YouTube that week. But I'll see. It really depends on what is promoted for the show. I'm looking forward to watching it. As far as what I actually review that week on the channel, we'll have to wait and see. But I'm very excited that they are finally resurrecting Halloween Havoc, and they must bring back the inflatable pumpkin. It was the best part of that whole Halloween Havoc set. They would have like tombstones and graves on the side, but you got to have the inflatable pumpkin. To me, it's not Halloween Havoc if you don't have the inflatable pumpkin. The WWE Performance Center has been renamed. It has been rebranded. The Capital Wrestling Center, which will be the new home for NXT going forward. The name is an homage to the old Capital Wrestling Corporation name from the early days of the company and its birth, its inception. 60 something years ago now, probably early 50s, almost 70. I think that the look and the feel is really cool. I think it makes for a very cool atmosphere there. They have a mixture of some Thunderdome elements. They have the wall of virtual fans, but they have actual people in the building as well, friends and family. I think they had about 100 people in there. So it's a mix of both. I just think it looks cool. The vibe in there is very cool. I'm shocked. Maybe I shouldn't be because Triple H is an old school guy, but they have wrestling in the name now. They've taken the Performance Center, which did not have the word wrestling, and they have turned it into the Capital Wrestling Center. I'm very impressed. This was clearly not a Vince McMahon decision, although he would have probably had to, throw his input into this. But they actually have the word wrestling in the name of the venue now. Finn Balor at TakeOver last Sunday, TakeOver 31, he retained his NXT championship over Kyle O'Reilly. Excellent main event. It came, though, at a cost. It came at the cost of a broken jaw, broken in two places. It came on a knee lift in the corner by O'Reilly that connected a little too well. Balor immediately began bleeding from the mouth. He apparently called an audible for the match to end a few minutes early. It did feel like they went right to the finish after that. When he hit the coup de grace, I thought O'Reilly was kicking out. And when he didn't, I thought, okay, maybe they did rush the finish. Maybe he is really hurt. They did not strip, at least not yet. They have not stripped Balor of the championship. They have not vacated the championship. I mean, back-to-back vacancies would have been crazy. Although I'm sure Vacant is licking his lips right now. He's just waiting in the wings. But it looks like they're going to keep the title on Balor while he heals up. No timetable was given for his return. The typical recovery in fishing around for a broken jaw is said to be around 6 weeks. I don't know if that differs when you broke your jaw in more than one place, as Balor did. The x-ray looked pretty gnarly. But if he's going to be gone, let's say 6 weeks, then they have time. The next TakeOver show is not until December 6th. So they could keep him out of the ring, name a number one contender, start building to that match, but actually keep him out of anything physical until the next TakeOver. And by then, hopefully, he'll be all healed up. And then there is poor Ridge Holland, who absolutely, positively will not be back in time for the next TakeOver. In fact, we have seen the last of Ridge Holland here in 2020. This is a man that I've been impressed by. So has WWE, which is why he was in the final scene of TakeOver last Sunday. He had Adam Cole's dead body hoisted over his shoulder, dumped him on the floor. Someone apparently paid off Ridge Holland, like a hitman, to take out Adam Cole. Hence why when Holland showed up on NXT this week, the interview person caught him outside the building. He arrived driving a Mercedes. And he said, last week I didn't have a Mercedes, and this week I do. And basically the implication was somebody paid him off. It's a whodunit. Who paid off this man to attack Adam Cole? Maybe it was Pat McAfee. Maybe McAfee's not done yet with Adam Cole. Unfortunately, this storyline took a very bad turn later that night. Holland was in a match with Danny Burch that he won very quickly. Oney Lorcan came out after to chase off Holland. The two locked horns. Referees poured out to try to separate the two of them. And in this melee, this is what is so frustrating about something like this. If you watch this segment, there were two or three different points after they were pulled apart for the third time in the same segment that they could have ended the segment. Just separate them. The referees already pulled them apart two or three times. You could have ended the segment right there. But they kept it going. They kept having these two go after each other. They prolonged it. And then came the dive. Another fucking dive. Except it wasn't Ridge Holland doing the dive. He didn't do anything wrong. It was Oney Lorcan. And it was a very simple, basic dive. It wasn't even one of these running dives. You know, that's what some of these devastating injuries. We just got Xavier Woods back. We just got Ember Moon back. Two people who suffered devastating Achilles injuries that kept them out for almost a year or a year. And in the case of Ember, she was running. She was running to the back, chasing after R-Truth. In the case of Xavier Woods, it happened early in a match. I think it might have been a leapfrog. It was like a very, maybe not even a leapfrog. He might have just been running the ropes. It was something very, very basic. Same thing when Edge, you know, ruptured his Achilles all those years ago. It was on a leapfrog in the corner 2 minutes into a match with Jeff Hardy. It's not like these guys were doing these overly dangerous maneuvers. So when you do these dives and these dangerous maneuvers, it only amplifies the risk by that much. But even in terms of dives, this was a very basic dive. This was not, you know, anything that, you know, saw him do some kind of corkscrew plancha. You know, he's running 50 miles an hour, running the ropes. No. It was nothing like that. All Ridge did was stand there to catch him. Oney propelled himself. He grabbed the top rope and he propelled himself out over the top rope. And Ridge was to, I assume, catch him in midair, but his leg buckled and it snapped. And it took all of, I'd say, maybe 3 seconds, maybe not even 2 seconds. The blood-curdling screams of Ridge Holland. The referees that were standing right there, they very quickly realized, this is not part of the story. This is not part of the work. He's hurt. And you had Drake Unger. I think it was Drake who was standing right there. He dove at Oni because Oni got right back. You know, he was on top of Holland. He was pounding away. And Drake just like tackled him to get him off. And then he threw up the X, the dreaded X sign. And it was pretty apparent right away that this guy was legitimately hurt. Now, to me, when they showed the replay, you could clearly see his ankle bent the wrong way. So I figured, okay, this is easily a broken ankle. But it turned out to be so much worse. Not only did he break his left ankle, he dislocated the ankle, which they tried to pop back into place backstage, but they couldn't do it. They couldn't do it until they got to the ER. I don't even want to know the kind of pain that this guy must have been in when they tried to pop the ankle back into place and they couldn't. I mean, I can't say that I've ever had an injury like this before, and I hope I never do. But when it comes to like popping things back in, and my memory's a little fuzzy because I was so young, but I was probably, I don't know, 6 or 7 years old, maybe five or six years old. And I mean, I had my arm pulled out of the socket and I had to have the doctor pop it back in. And I can vaguely remember being in a lot of pain. And as soon as he popped it back in, like the pain, it was gone. Like the pain went away. I can't imagine an injury like this, though, when they're trying to pop it back in and they can't. It's like, we're trying here and it's just, you know, it's just not working. Oh, I don't even want to think about that. I hope they gave him a towel or something to bite down on. Because this guy was screaming bloody murder when he first went down, and you can understand why. So, broken ankle, as well as a dislocated and ruptured right patellar tendon. So he ruptured his patellar tendon. So it was the knee and the ankle. That makes it just twice as bad. He had surgery the next morning. Who the hell knows when he's going to be back? That sounds like a long layoff. I'm not saying it's going to be like a year or anything like that. I've read that either injury on its own could be 6 to 8 weeks. It could be 6 months. Who knows? He's going to be out for a long time. And there's never a good time to get hurt with an injury like that, but this was the absolute worst possible time for something like this to happen, because here this guy was on the verge of the biggest push of his career. Now, I think he's a relatively young guy, and hopefully he can come back from this, and he'll have plenty of other opportunities, I would hope. But again, the timing just makes this so much worse. And where they're going to take this story now, I don't know. They already started it, and they were kind of teasing that this guy was paid off. So they could still continue the storyline. I don't know where the destination is going to go, if it is McAfee or somebody else. Somebody put him up to doing what he did. Now we'll have to figure out who that person is. Or they could just abandon the whole thing. If they want to do that, they could do that too. They could just say, you know what, we had a story with Ridge. Ridge is out. We're just going to drop the whole thing and go in a different direction. Now, you know my thoughts on this, the dive stuff. You know my thoughts on this without me even saying a word. In the last 2 months, we have had injuries to Dexter Lumis, Ivar of the Viking Raiders, and now Ridge Holland, all coming as a result of dives out of the ring. In the case of Ridge, he wasn't the one actually doing the diving. But it doesn't matter. It was still a dive spot, and it didn't need to happen. It added nothing to the segment. Nothing. As these dives usually do. They add nothing. And why do they add nothing? Because they've been so overdone. How could they possibly mean anything anymore? They have no meaning. There is no longer any logical reason to keep doing them. Please, I beg of you again before somebody else gets hurt. Enough with the fucking dives. Ember Moon. She was the returning NXT star who showed up at TakeOver last Sunday. If you remember my picks on who it could be, I picked one man and one woman. I thought it was Bo Dallas if it was somebody going after the NXT championship. It's kind of sad, honestly, to see that it wasn't the old kind of Bo Dallas coming back to NXT. If it was a woman, then I said it was probably Ember Moon. And that's who it turned out to be. She has tweaked her character a little bit, a little less, you know, the brooding stuff. Now she says she found Ember's Law and she's going to do what she wants. She's like, I'm Ember Moon, damn it. I'm going to use that line too. Whenever I don't get what I want. You know, like if I'm in Walgreens and they say they're all out of Bounty paper towels, I'll be like, I'm going to just shout at the top of my lungs, I'm the Salamonster, Monster, damn it. And see what happens. Probably nothing. Probably nothing. Somebody will pull out their phone and they'll start filming and they'll call me a Karen. That's what'll happen. Io Shirai came out to confront her. Then Rhea Ripley came out. Rhea was immediately attacked from behind by Dakota Kai and Raquel Gonzalez. And that led to the main event, which was a tag team match playa. We had Ember and Rhea picking up the win over Dakota and Raquel. I have to say, that was the best eclipse that I have ever seen Ember Moon pull off. That eclipse that she hit on Dakota Kai was very impressive. She put a little extra something on that one. I had forgotten how cool of a finish it was because it never really stood out as anything special when I saw her do it on the main roster. It's amazing what a move back to NXT can do for a person. All of a sudden, this woman is flying through the air doing the best eclipse that I've ever seen in my life. They also aired a great video package interviewing Toni Storm. Almost overnight, it feels like they have breathed new life into this women's division, which is why I really don't mind if they want to just kind of keep Rhea where she is and she stays put for a little while longer, even though she's ready for Raw. I mean, she's ready for Raw or SmackDown right now. She can move today and fit right in and I think make big contributions to that women's division. But if they want to keep her around at NXT and do some of these matches, keep her around for a few more months until the end of the year, I'm okay with that. And I am enjoying the odd couple pairing of Drake Maverick and Killian Dane. I think it's good for Dane, who was just sort of meandering around before with not much going on. He absolutely does not want to team with this man. But Drake will not take no for an answer. And their theme music, their new theme music that Drake, I guess, picked out himself, is like something out of a cheesy, awful television sitcom. Watching Killian Dane walk out to that music was legitimately funny. And I laughed out loud when they hit the music and they come walking out. And people don't know what to think. They don't know how to react. Killian is just, he is incredulous to this. And Drake has a big fat smile on his face. And I literally laughed out loud when Wade Barrett on commentary, he just says, in that accent of his, he hears this music and he just goes, what the hell is this? Just the way he said it, I swear to you, I legitimately laughed out loud. And that does not happen very often. I will often laugh on the inside because they do such stupid shit on like Monday nights and sometimes on Friday nights that they make me maniacal. I sound like the Joker. I will be laughing internally, sometimes externally. You hear that laugh at the beginning of the show every week. I included it in the intro. That was the laugh that sent me over the edge. I don't remember what show that was. It might have been the night that the McMahons actually stood in the ring and said that we're going to freshen things up by taking control of the show. I think that's what sent me over the edge. But this was a positive laugh. This was a laugh out of fun. This was a good thing. And Ever-Rise, they beat Ever-Rise. Now I know Matt Martell and Chase Parker, basically jobbers to the stars on this show, but hopefully not for too much longer. I really like those guys. I really like them. So there's a lot of good pieces in place right now in NXT. The Ridge Holland thing though was just a real black mark on the show this week. And look, all the best to the guy. It's a devastating injury. Hopefully he can come back from it. It's one thing to break an ankle or suffer a knee injury, but to do both at the same time is not good.
History has been made here!
This week in wrestling history, we begin 23 years ago on October 5th, 1997. A very newsworthy day in wrestling for both good and bad reasons. We'll start with the bad. Brian Pillman, who was scheduled to wrestle Dude Love that night at the WWE Bad Blood pay-per-view in your house, And I think Goldust as well. Oh, no, you know what I was? I think Goldust would have been handcuffed to the post. So that's what it was. It wasn't two matches. I think it was going to be Pillman against Dude Love. And Pillman was still feuding with Goldust at the time. He had Goldust's wife, Marlena. He had won her over as his manager. And I think Goldust was going to be handcuffed to the post. Instead, none of this ever happened. Because Pillman was found dead in his hotel room at the age of 35 from what was later deemed to be a heart attack. He had wrestled Goldust the night before at a live event and was said to not look very good. He was sleeping on the floor backstage, you know, during the matches, which he never did before. He clearly was not feeling well. I think people probably just chalked it up to him just being tired and being exhausted and drinking too much and what have you, which, you know, he was doing that as well. And when he didn't show up to the show the next day, they started to get concerned. So they had Jim Cornette call the hotel where he was staying. And depending on who you talk to, it was either Cornette or Bruce Pritchard, who was the first person to actually be told that the police had found Pillman dead in his room. According to Terry Runnels, the plan was for she and Goldust to come back together on Raw during a wedding ceremony. Because at the time, again, she was sort of Pillman's reluctant servant or reluctant slave on TV, for lack of a better word. But during the wedding, what would happen is that Pillman would come out, he would bloody up Goldust, and Marlena would basically turn on Goldust. Kind of like what Stephanie did when she turned on her father and she went with Triple H. And they got together as an item. This would have been a similar situation and she would have left with Pillman. So according to her, that was the plan. When I heard the news, I can remember it like it was yesterday. When I heard the news, I wasn't home. I was in Florida. I was in Florida on a family vacation, a rare family vacation. In fact, I don't think we took another family vacation after that. We couldn't afford one. But I was so obsessed with wrestling at the time, right? You had these two competing companies. I was more of a WWF guy than a WCW guy. But I was such an obsessed fan at the time, I was pissed because I was missing the pay-per-view that night. And so I called into one of these many fan hotlines that there were at the time, and I can remember the guy on the other end of the line mentioning that Brian Pillman was found dead in his hotel room, which is a pretty easy way to ruin one's vacation. So that was stunning to hear. But it was a huge loss, not only for his family, but for the wrestling business. Now imagine Loose Cannon Brian Pillman running around during the Attitude Era. You know, if Pillman was still around, you know, that next year after Austin won the championship at WrestleMania, and I think it was Meltzer who said that Pillman was already looking to leave and go back to WCW at the time. And I know Meltzer was very close with Pillman. They were very friendly with each other. And had he been alive when Montreal happened, you know, I mean, if he was really loyal to Brett, he may have wanted out of the company regardless. Right, that's what happened with the Bulldog. The Bulldog paid $150,000 out of his own pocket to buy himself out of his own contract so that he could leave. And he went to WCW. The only one that Vince wouldn't let go of was Owen. Owen wanted to leave, and Vince said, no, I'm not going to let you out of your contract. But the Bulldog bought his way out. Would the same have happened with Pillman? Who knows? But I could see Pillman being so loyal that he wouldn't want to come back anyway. But let's say that Pillman stayed. And I know his ankle was all jacked up and he couldn't do what he used to do. He would have been a natural first feud for Steve Austin coming out of WrestleMania, or maybe the feud coming off, you know, after the Dude Love feud. Maybe they wanted Austin to feud with Dude Love for a couple of shows, get a couple of big wins, and maybe then, you know, he could have moved on to a program with Pillman. But, you know, if it wasn't for that damn Humvee wreck back in 96... You know, what happened was Pillman had convinced Eric Bischoff to give him his actual release papers to make it seem real. He wanted to go all the way with the whole Loose Cannon deal, and he got it. He got his release papers, his legal official release papers, I think faxed to him by WCW. Bischoff gave it to him. And in the middle of, as all of this was going on, and he was in the midst of probably the biggest, you know, break of his career, he's riding this Hummer and he falls asleep at the wheel and he flips it. and he shattered his ankle so badly that he had to have it fused together in one position. And he was in constant pain for the rest of his life. I mean, that accident was no joke. He was in a coma for a week. He almost died. But he got himself a WWF contract coming out of it. He had duped Bischoff. You know, I mean, he ended up signing with WWF, which I don't think was... That's not what Bischoff was thinking would happen. Maybe he would go to ECW or something, and he did. But not that he would go sign with Vince McMahon. That was definitely not part of the plan. But he was never the same. You know, from the moment he signed that contract, he was already hurt. You know, it was many, many, many more months before he would even wrestle a match. But they signed him, and they made a big deal about his... I remember that first press conference, that mock press conference they did, and he was going off. He was like a loose cannon. You know, that was the gimmick that he was playing. But he was never the same, unfortunately, after that wreck. And to this day, one of the most tasteless segments in the history of WWE television is Vince McMahon parading Pillman's pregnant wife, his pregnant widow, on Raw the very next night and peppering her with all these questions. What now? What are you going to do now? You know, ridiculous. 5 kids left behind. Soon to be 6. Because again, his wife, Melanie, was pregnant. 6 kids who lost their father that day. And a few hours after learning that their colleague had passed away, Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker, they went out and had one of the greatest matches in WWE history. The first ever Hell in a Cell. After all their years on the same roster, it was only a month earlier at the Ground Zero pay-per-view that Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker had a singles match. They went one-on-one, at least on TV. They went one-on-one for the very first time. Their paths had crossed. And so this was the rematch. And it was great. I'm talking about Ground Zero. I love the match, the fight that they had at that Ground Zero pay-per-view in September. This all stemmed from Michaels costing Undertaker the championship in his match with Bret Hart at SummerSlam. And think about all that came out of this, right? Shortly thereafter, we had the formation of DX. At the same time, the company had been teasing the debut of Undertaker's little brother, his little brother Kane, that Undertaker never knew was still alive. Glenn Jacobs' final chance. He went from Isaac Yankem to the fake Diesel. It was now or never. Either this gimmick was going to succeed, or he would end up probably as somebody that Lex Luger could have beaten on a random episode of WCW Saturday Night. That probably would have been his destiny. But the show was in St. Louis, Bad Blood. It was in St. Louis. That's Kane's hometown. He was visiting his parents that day. A friend of his offered to give him a ride to the arena. And the friend's car broke down on the way to the building. And so for a while, Kane didn't think he was going to make it in time. He was trying to race to the building to get there on time. But he did. And what resulted was what I maintain to this day, the single greatest debut for any wrestler in WWE history. Better than Chris Jericho, who had a great debut. Better than Taz, who also had a great debut in Madison Square Garden. The Rock debuting as Rocky Maivia at Survivor Series in the Garden and winning. The Nexus on Raw that first night. Kevin Owens when he debuted. All great memorable debuts. And I know a lot of you may rank Jericho above Kane, but I disagree. Kane is still the best of all the debuts. This man walks out with a wall of flames, a wall of fire behind him, looking just, I mean, that original Kane mask and everything is just so fucking badass. He comes walking out, he rips the cage door off its hinges. He tombstones The Undertaker, one of the biggest stars in the company, lays him out, and plays into the finish of what would end up becoming one of the great matches of all time. It doesn't get much better than that. And it makes me sad to see what The Cell has been reduced to in recent years. There have been a lot of great Hell in a Cell matches. We just had one last year, in fact, with Sasha Banks and Becky Lynch. But in my opinion, none have been better than the original. I still think after all these years, over 20 years later, The Undertaker and Shawn Michaels' Hell in a Cell match is still the best of all the Hell in a Cell matches. Now, Undertaker and Mankind is more iconic, but Shawn and Undertaker, to me, is the better match. 22 years ago this week, on the October 5th, 1998 episode of Raw is War, that gave us the classic Dr. Austin segment with Vince McMahon in the hospital with a broken ankle after being attacked the week before by Kane and The Undertaker. Stone Cold Steve Austin shows up in McMahon's hospital room dressed as a doctor. He beats the hell out of him. He smashes a bedpan over his head. He gives him an enema. The sound of that bedpan, that bedpan shot is just perfect. I still get a nice laugh out of that when I watch it back. The segment also saw Mankind try to cheer up the boss. He tried to cheer up Vince McMahon before he got attacked with the debut of Mr. Socko, which would go on to make Mick Foley a lot of money. And I know this because I was one of the schmucks who spent $8 on one sock from WWE shop. I could have at least bought two. I could have at least bought two of them. I only bought one. I still have it. I still have my $8 Mr. Socko. And we also had Yurple the Clown. Let us not forget about Yurple the Clown making her debut on that segment as well. 21 years ago this week on October 5th, 1999, at a SmackDown taping from the Nassau Coliseum in Long Island, New York, as D'Lo Brown hoisted up Darren Drozdov for a running powerbomb attempt in the corner, something went terribly wrong. Droz landed on his head. He fractured two discs in his neck, paralyzed him from the neck down. He did later regain the use of his upper body, but he remains paralyzed to this very day. He is still paralyzed from the waist down. SmackDown was taped in those days, so the match never aired. And as far as anybody knows, the video, it does exist, but it's locked away in the WWF vault, probably right alongside the footage of Owen Hart's fall. Yeah, the only video that we've really ever seen from that segment is from the old Don't Try This at Home video that WWE used to put together. They briefly show him being lifted up in the ring and taken out on a stretcher. Droz has said many times that he does not hold D'Lo responsible for what happened, even that night. I think Mick Foley talked about this in his book, like at the hospital, because D'Lo went with him. And the whole time Droz is like, dude, it's not your fault. Don't beat yourself up over it. Shit happens. So he's never blamed D'Lo. Look, D'Lo, I'm sure, has carried a lot of guilt regardless. It's nice that Droz would say that, and it was. It was a freak accident. I don't know that anybody is to blame. I don't know that anybody did anything wrong. It's just one of those things that happens. But if you're D'Lo Brown, you know, you don't really get over something like that. That you're going to carry that for the rest of your life. That you were in the ring with this guy when this accident happened, and you're going to be thinking to yourself and beating yourself up, what could I have done differently? If I just moved here, if I did this, if I didn't do that. That's what I would do. I'd beat myself up over it for the rest of my life. But accidents happen. You know, as Droz said, shit happens, and unfortunately it happened to him. It's just kind of part of the risks that goes along with being a pro wrestler. The very next day, on October 6th, 1999, Gorilla Monsoon passed away, the monster from Manchuria, whose manager, when he first came in, his manager claimed that he discovered Monsoon walking around naked in a mountain stream. I'm glad he made that discovery and not I. That's all I can say about that. But the angle that he's probably most well known for is the one where he gave Muhammad Ali an airplane spin on TV. Ali was there as part of building up this big wrestler versus boxer match against Antonio Inoki in Japan. Nothing ever came out of Monsoon giving him the airplane spin. But it did give birth to a famous Monsoon phrase that he would use many other times over the years when he said that he was talking about Ali and how he's got no business being here. He's got no business being in the ring because he did not know a wrist lock from a wristwatch. You can credit Gorilla Monsoon with that quote. After he retired, he would run the backstage area at television, which is where the Gorilla Position name comes from. Before wrestlers would go out, you know, Monsoon would be the last or one of the last faces that they saw. When he had to relay cues to the referees to kind of take the match home, this is before the referees had earpieces in their ears and they could just relay commands to them. He would just, I guess they could see him. I don't know how they would see him, but from the ring, the wrestlers and the referee, they could glance over and they can see Monsoon maybe standing there. And I guess the cue is that when he would take his glasses off, that meant that it was time to take the match home. I always love, like, learning about little things like that. So that's how they did things back then. Monsoon was the wrestler, Gorilla Monsoon, was before my time. So I don't really have any memories of Gorilla Monsoon as a wrestler outside of, you know, the old shows that I've watched, and I've seen the Ali angle, but I didn't grow up watching Gorilla Monsoon wrestle. I grew up listening to Gorilla Monsoon's voice, and I know a lot of you did too. I would hear him on television. I would hear him and Jesse the Body Ventura. I would hear him and Bobby the Brain Heenan. I mean, he really was the voice of my childhood in many ways. Mean Gene was another voice of my childhood. Vince McMahon was a voice. Gorilla Monsoon was one of those voices. And so it was him and Jesse, and it was him and Bobby. My two favorite announced duos of all time, by the way. In that order, Gorilla Monsoon and Bobby the Brain Heenan, number one. Can never be topped. Gorilla and the Body are my number two. If I had to rank them, I think I've done this before. That's my A1 and my A2. If I had to go with the number three would probably be JR and the King. But I was also a big fan of Vince McMahon and Jesse. I probably would do McMahon and Ventura at number four. You know, that's how I would rank my announce teams. Now, in 94, unfortunately, he lost his son in a car accident on the New Jersey Turnpike. That was referee Joey Morella. He had a lot of health issues in later years, even though he had a stint. He was the on-camera president for WWF for a while. They gave him that role once Jack Tunney sort of disappeared. And, you know, look, he was on television. Some people may not know this, but he was on television. Straight through the part, halfway maybe, through the Attitude Era. He was still doing voiceover work for the international version of WWF Superstars. I know for a fact that he did commentary and voiceovers for the UK edition. So for the UK version of Superstars, I know he did. The last time that fans saw him on television was ringside as a guest judge at WrestleMania 15, the same year that he died. He was a guest judge for the Brawl for All Slaughter with Butterbean and Bart Gunn, and it was shocking to see him. It was shocking how much weight he had lost. He looked gaunt. I remember him looking gaunt, but also looking kind of jaundiced. I don't know if I'm just remembering it, like misremembering it, but he definitely looked gaunt and just very frail, almost. He did not look well. And in September of that year, he suffered a heart attack. That caused a lot of complications with his diabetes. And he made the decision, he made the call to be taken off kidney dialysis and go home. And he went home from the hospital, he got home the day before he died. And the next day, he was gone. 21 years ago this week, on October 10th, 1999, the date of the infamous Heroes of Wrestling pay-per-view, quite possibly the worst pay-per-view in wrestling history. I know December to Dismember is in the conversation as well. But a lot of people, and I probably would throw my own name in that hat, would consider this to be the worst pay-per-view of all time. So a man by the name of Bill Stone had an idea. He was going to capitalize off of wrestling's popularity at the time. It was the height of the Attitude Era. And his idea was that he would host a series of pay-per-views made up of big wrestling stars from the 80s, big wrestling stars from the early 90s. Eventually, I think WWF got in touch with him. They tried to shut the whole thing down. And I think he had to promise them, like, okay, this is just a one and done. I'm not going to do any more of these. And then they sort of backed off. But that was his idea. 15 WWE Hall of Famers were featured on this show. Unfortunately for Mr. Stone, but thankfully for the rest of us, again, there was only the one show. There was only the one show. And even if WWF didn't try to come after them and threaten them with, you know, legal action, there probably would have only been one show anyway. And that's largely due to the atrocity that was the main event. It was scheduled to be a double main event. Jake the Snake Roberts against Jim the Anvil Neidhart and King Kong Bundy against Yokozuna, who, to say that he was morbidly obese by this point would be an understatement. He was such a health hazard that WWE, they couldn't use him anymore because many of the state athletic commissions wouldn't license him. He was a danger. He was too much of a risk. And so you can understand why he ended up passing away a year later. King Kong Bundy, at one point, called him Porkazuna, which is funny coming from King Kong Bundy, who was hardly a GQ cover model himself. But Yokozuna was not the problem. The problem was Jake the Snake Roberts, who was a wreck. This was at the height of his problems. He was definitely in the grips of some serious issues at that time, some serious substance abuse issues. And he showed up for the pre-match promo completely wasted, slurring his words. But then came the match. It got worse. Jake comes down to the ring with his snake. He sits the bag down. He stumbles to the back. He comes back out. This time now, he's got no shirt on, which was not a pleasant sight. He takes this lady's hands in the front row, and he starts rubbing them on his nipples. Then he pulls the snake out of the bag. He sticks it between his legs, and he pretends that it was his little python. Neidhart has no idea what to make of any of this. When Jim Neidhart is the one trying to make sense of things, you know that you've truly screwed up. When it's too much for even Jim the Anvil Neidhart, when even Jim Neidhart looks at this and goes, hold on a second here, I think we've gone too far, then you know something is wrong. So the announcers start talking about random things. They're trying to stall until they can figure out what to do here, because this guy is clearly in no condition to perform. And so all of a sudden, out comes King Kong Bundy. He ends up having a little conference with Neidhart. They're trying to figure out what to do here. They gang up on Jake. Out comes Yokozuna. He eventually comes out, and they announce that now it is a tag team match. They have called an audible. They have turned this double main event into a tag team match. Jake was just stumbling around all over the place. This match went 16 minutes, by the way. 16 minutes of this nonsense. Finally, Bundy pins Jake with a splash. The referee did a fast count. I think Yokozuna was the legal man. It doesn't matter. Afterwards, some bald guy ran in and got Samoan dropped by Yokozuna. Jake put the snake on top of him, and then mercifully, this show was finally over. Now, if you watch the video back on YouTube, they fade out, and about 20 or 30 seconds go by, and then they come back to the arena for one last shot with the logo on the bottom of the screen. And in the ring, you see Yokozuna standing in the corner, and Jake, who was upright when they faded out, is now laying down, passed out on the canvas. Dutch Mantel, he was providing color commentary for the show. And Captain Lou Albano, I think for a match or two, also may have done some commentary. But Dutch Mantel was the color guy, and he was doing commentary with Randy Rosenbloom. Now you might be saying, who the fuck is Randy Rosenbloom? Well, I'm glad you asked. Randy Rosenbloom was the replacement for Gordon Solie. Gordon Solie was going to be the play-by-play man for this show, and thank Christ he wasn't. Can you imagine Gordon Solie, who passed away, it wasn't that long after the show, I think, maybe next year, that he passed away. But can you imagine if Gordon Solie was on this show, being associated with this show as like his final lasting memory? Which it would have been. I mean, this show has gone down in infamy. This would have been the lasting memory that was associated with Gordon Solie. Thank God he was not there. He had been diagnosed with throat cancer prior to this show. I don't know how long prior to this show. The prevailing wisdom is that because of that, he was forced to pull out of the show. In fact, that is not the case. He wanted to do the show. He was still open to doing the show. He wanted a first-class plane ticket to get there, and Bill Stone refused to pay for one. So he apparently paid all these other legends, but he wouldn't pay for a first-class ticket for Gordon Solie, who was already sick by that point. And so in his place, Stone called in a favor from a guy that he had worked with before. He was a professional broadcaster of 20 years, Randy Rosenbloom. Had no experience, though, for all those 20 years, no experience whatsoever calling professional wrestling. In fact, he knew nothing about pro wrestling. He knew nothing about the moves. He knew nothing about the stars. He was trying to do his homework before the show. He went over to the guys. What's your finishing move? Is there anything you want me to mention about you? Like, he was trying. He was trying to learn. He was trying to get a crash course, but he didn't know anything. He was actually supposed to be calling a UCLA-Oregon football game on the radio that day, which he pulled out of, I guess, because the money that he was offered for this gig was a lot better. So he took the money. I can't say that I blame the guy. But he was really awful when it came to calling wrestling moves, to the point that Dutch Mantel became openly hostile to this guy. I feel sorry for him, because it's not his fault. I mean, yes, he said yes to the gig. He could have said no, but look, he was trying. But Rosenbloom is convinced that Dutch just didn't like him. He never gave him a shot. He thought it was unprofessional for him to do that on the air. But he was just being hostile towards the guy. You know, he called an arm drag at one point, a reverse slam takedown. He called a drop kick, a leg drop, just like stuff like that. Stupid stuff like that. And I guess Dutch just got fed up with him. And Rosenbloom says that it's the one thing in his career that bothers him. He probably gets too much flack. He didn't know wrestling. He did the best he could with it. But this show was a complete embarrassment. And quite possibly the worst show of all time. 20 years ago this week, on October 9th, 2000, after an exhaustive investigation by Commissioner Mick Foley, it was revealed that Rikishi was the culprit who ran down Stone Cold Steve Austin the year before at the Survivor Series in one of the most underwhelming reveals of all time. All the evidence pointed to The Rock. But in fact, it was Rikishi who famously said that he did it for The Rock. I did it for The Rock. And he talked about the Great White Hope. Yes, they brought racism into this angle. The Great White Hope, holding down the Island Boys. Holding down all the Samoan brothers. Which is hilarious, because he is saying this. He is cutting this promo. He is shooting on the Great White Hope, holding down the Island Boys. At the same time that right across the ring, standing right in front of him, the guy he allegedly did this for, The Rock, is standing there with the WWF Championship draped over his shoulder. And he is one of the two biggest stars in the entire company. And he's talking about, oh, they've held us down. I had to do this. They've held us down. Oh, they held you down, really. The guy's the WWF champion. It didn't make any sense then. It still doesn't make any sense all these years later. They tried to make sense out of it a little bit later by revealing that Triple H was the one who paid him off to run down Austin. The Rikishi singles push was all but over 2 months later. Undertaker chokeslammed him off the top of the Hell in a Cell. Rikishi got a great spot in that six-man Hell in a Cell at Armageddon. And the memorable spot was Undertaker. It wasn't even a chokeslam. It was like a choke shove. He shoved him off the top of the cage, and he fell back. He fell 16 feet down onto a flatbed truck. After that, that was it. You may as well kind of draw up a gif. And as Rikishi is falling, you can put the text over that says, Rikishi's push. Rikishi's singles push. As he falls down onto the flatbed truck. That was pretty much the end. He stuck around for a while. He still had some success, but not at that level. And soon after that, he was teaming with Haku. And then he got hurt and he missed the whole invasion period. 8 years ago, on October 8th, 2012, Brian Gewirtz was removed as the head writer of Monday Night Raw, coming off the heels of Raw doing one of its lowest ratings in 15 years the week before, against pretty stiff competition from Monday Night Football. There was a big game between the Bears, Dub Bears, right? Big game between the Bears and the Cowboys. Raw dropped to a measly 2.5 rating. So what does that equate to? What does the abysmally low audience that broke the camel's back, what was it that week? 3.5 million viewers. That is what everybody was talking about, being this horrible, horrible, lousy, abysmal Raw audience at the time. 3.5 million viewers. Raw is going to soon be doing 1.5 million viewers here in 2020. They might hit that mark in 2021. They've come close. They've gotten as low as 1.6. So they're in that neighborhood of doing 1.5 million viewers. But imagine an audience of 3.5 million. Had Vince McMahon at that time telling the producers that Raw the next week, you know, he got rid of Gewirtz, and he told all the producers he wants results or resignations. Notice how it's always someone else's fault. Maybe the one who should resign come up with the results that are needed, maybe he needs to look in the mirror and try to figure something out himself instead of always putting the blame on other people. I know he's hired these people to help write the shows and kind of help him out here. It's not all on him, but it just seems like it's always someone else's fault. My God, if Raw got 3.5 million viewers now, they'd be doing cartwheels. 7 years ago, on October 6, 2013, WWE hosted its first ever Battleground pay-per-view, which was a largely terrible show, save for one of my favorite WWE matches all year, a tag team match pitting the Rhodes Brothers, Cody and Goldust, against the Seth Rollins and Roman Reigns combo of The Shield. Cody had been fired on TV. Dustin was lobbying for his brother to get his job back. It led to this match. It led to this tag team match where if the Rhodes Brothers won, they would be reinstated. But if they lost, their father Dusty would be terminated from NXT and the entire family would be gone from World Wrestling Entertainment. That was the stipulation coming into the match. They did win. They won in dramatic fashion. With Dusty at ringside, he was given Dean Ambrose the bionic elbow. It was a great, great moment. He had all three of them together in the ring, celebrating, all emotional. Dusty was all emotional, seeing his boys get the win. Half the locker room came out once they got on stage to celebrate with them. This was great. This was pro wrestling in its finest form, and a fantastic match that I had to mention on what was an otherwise very forgettable show. This was one of my favorite WWE matches of 2013. 6 years ago this week, on October 5th, 2014, Lucha Underground taped its first ever Aztec Warfare match to crown the inaugural Lucha Underground champion. This did not air until January. Aztec Warfare was their answer to the Royal Rumble, only they did it better than WWE did. Eliminations could also come by pinfall or submission. The match lasted the length of the entire episode, so it lasted almost a full hour. Came down to Prince Puma and Johnny Mundo. Ricochet and John Morrison were in the main event here. And those two actually headlined the very first episode of Lucha Underground, so it was kind of appropriate that it would come down to the two of them. And here it was Puma winning to become the first ever Lucha Underground champion. You think Ricochet wishes he can go back to that? Publicly, he'll say no, but I think otherwise. And 5 years ago this week, on October 7th, 2015, NXT presented its TakeOver Respect show from Full Sail University, which featured the inaugural Dusty Rhodes Tag Team Classic in honor of the American Dream, who had passed away that June. Finn Balor and Samoa Joe beat Baron Corbin and Rhino in the finals to win, but not before a really fun semifinal match earlier in the show, with Corbin and Rhino beating Chad Gable and Jason Jordan, American Alpha. They were a fantastic tag team broken up far too soon. I will always remember popping huge when Gable gave Corbin the Chaos Theory. And for the finish, when Corbin turned a Gable tilt-a-whirl into an end of days. It was so fluid. Everything just clicked. It was just such a fun match. And I don't often associate that word with Baron Corbin, but that was a fun match. And in the main event, Bayley retained her NXT Women's Championship over Sasha Banks. Boy, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. This was the first ever women's Iron Man match. 30-minute time limit, not 60. I'm sure some of you remember my pleas on the podcast at the time for them to call this an Iron Maiden match. I thought it was a missed opportunity. Trademarks and copyrights be damned. I maintain that would have been a far cooler name. Call it the first ever Iron Maiden match for the ladies. But it was the first women's match to ever headline a WWE major show, a WWE pay-per-view, We did see Stephanie and Lita headline an episode of Raw once. Trish and Lita once, you know, main evented an episode of Raw. But never a pay-per-view. This was the first time. This was a classic. I still like their Brooklyn match better, but this one was right behind it. And if you want to see Sasha Banks at her heel best, making a little girl cry, little Izzy. She made Izzy cry. This was the match for you. Bayley won. She went on to win 3-2. If you've never seen it, find it on the network. It is worth going out of your way to see. And hopefully, in a few weeks at Hell in a Cell, here we are 5 years later, hopefully they can recreate some of that magic. It won't be the same because there's no live audience. So it can't be the same. But hopefully they can recapture some of the magic of their matches from 5 years ago. If you have questions for the mailbag, you can always email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. We're not going to get to it this week because the draft stuff, I knew the draft stuff was going to take up a lot of time. But definitely email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. I do see everything you send to me. And you never know what may be used and when it may be used here on the show. Follow me on Twitter @solomonster. I would be so happy if you gave us a subscribe on YouTube. We are now less than 20 subscribers away from hitting the 60,000 milestone. We should hit it this week. You could be number 60K. But I can't get there without your help. So please sub to the channel if you have not already done so. There's a few hours left in that Pro Wrestling Tee sale here on Sunday. If you want to use the code FALL at checkout, you can get 20% off. But even without the code, if the sale's over by the time you listen to this, head on over to prowrestlingtees.com/solomonstersoundsoff. Check out the new 13-year anniversary shirt. It's a play off the whole Friday the 13th theme. I think you might like it. And buy the shirt. And if you do, take a picture of it when you get it and tweet it to me so I can share it with the world. I'll be back with you live on YouTube this Wednesday night for the AEW Dynamite Anniversary Recap, and I'm going to be back here with episode 674 of the podcast. We are marching towards 700. We still have a ways to go. What is that, another 25 weeks or something, 26 weeks? That's a while, but we are on the march to 700. I'll see you for 674 next Sunday. Until then, be well, stay safe. Thank you again. All the birthday wishes I got this week and all the super chats the other night, PayPals, all that stuff, it means the world to me. So thank you. I have the best fans in the world. And I hope you'll come on back and join me again next week. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonster sounds off.
I mean, it's similar to the Jeff Jarrett situation. He dropped the championship and then he burned a bridge for many, many years. That's why when WCW went under, Vince McMahon went on television and specifically singled his name out as somebody they would never hire. And now, all these years later, he's back with the company. What we've learned over the years is whether it's Jeff Jarrett or the Ultimate Warrior or Bret Hart or Bruno Sammartino, eventually they always come back home.
The Solomonster Sounds Off, available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesolomonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow The Solomonster on Twitter @Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Solomonster Sounds Off.